Colleagues, it looks like our order today will be first Senate Concurrent Resolution 7. Then we will take up Senate Bill 899. After that, we will have work session on Senate Bill 7 and finish up with Senate Bill 260. So with that, let's open up a public hearing on SCR 7. And Senator Gordley.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Avelle Gordley. I represent Senate District 23, which includes wonderful neighborhoods in northeast and southeast Portland. And it is a distinct honor and privilege this afternoon to carry this resolution, which acknowledges in memoriam Charles Britton Maxey. Mr. Maxey lived from February 13, 1917 to February 13, 2001. In fact, we shared the same birthday. Mr. Maxey, as is stated in the resolution that you have before you, was born to Robert and Virgie Maxey and San Augustine, Texas. Thank you very much. And he graduated from Texas College with dual degrees in economics and secondary education. He married his Kappa Alpha Psi sweetheart, Johnny Obina Sample, on October 15, 1939. And then they moved their family to Portland, Oregon in 1942. They had five children. And Mr. Maxey, among many, many, many accomplishments in his life, was the first African-American to attend the Young National Republican Convention, and he was also someone with a great entrepreneurial spirit. He and his wife owned and operated several businesses in the Northeast Portland community, including Maxey Better Buy Grocery Store, a store I happened to visit a lot as a child, the Maxey Barbershop, a dry cleaner, and an appliance store. And Mr. Maxey also served as an Oregon Liquor Control Commission agent. He was a community leader and activist on issues ranging from politics and social justice and the administration of justice. He always spoke out about discrimination. He was, and I think this is where he is most renowned, was an advocate for equal opportunity, supporting equal opportunity in all fields, and did a lot of his work through his church, which was the Bethel African Methodist Episcopal Church, through the National Association for the Advancement of Colored People, which we all know as the NAACP, through the Urban League, through the Young Republican Party, through the Parent Teachers Association, through the Jefferson High School and Benson High School Dads Club, the Leisure Hour Golf Club, the Texas Social Club, Kappa Alpha Psi Fraternity, Little League, Connie Mack Basketball, and also the Barbershop Connection. He received an Honorary Freedom Award citation from the NAACP, the Emerald Award for Lifetime Achievement from Alpha Kappa Alpha Sorority, an Entrepreneurial Award from the State of Oregon. He was a member of the African American Advisory Board to the Chief of Police of Portland, and was also a member of the Labor and Industry Committee of the NAACP. I'm citing the accomplishments of this great man because he truly was a legend and a giant in the community for his generation, and he certainly is a giant when it comes to recording Oregon's civil rights history. He was part of that effort that moved Oregon to pass a public accommodations law under the leadership of Mark Hatfield. You can see from the resolution that there were many other awards and honors bestowed upon Mr. Maxey, But I would also like the record to reflect that he was a great, he had a great impact on a lot of people from my generation. And if Senators Carter and Winters were here, they would also speak to you about how Mr. Maxey impacted their lives. Those of us who grew up in North Northeast Portland at a time when, in fact, our parents and our families were our role models. Those were the folks that we looked to because they were the folks who were the community builders during that time. We know that we owe a great deal to the efforts of Mr. Maxey and others of his generation. And because it was through his efforts and through his influence that my generation began to see beyond the limitations placed on us by discrimination. I would tell you that Mr. Maxey's story is an Oregon story. It is a story that belongs in our history books. I'm very pleased to share with you, which I believe you already know, that some elements of his story are already captured by the Oregon Historical Society. But there's even more that could be shared and should be shared through our history books that tell Oregon's story and that would share with Oregon's children who some of our esteemed Oregonians and leaders are and have been who championed social justice, equal justice for all people. Again, my point is that Mr. Maxey is one of those folks. So again, it's just a great privilege and pleasure to bring before you this resolution. We had members of the Maxey family, including Mrs. Maxey, with us on the Senate side when the resolution passed that floor unanimously. And I also would like you to know that the family is just deeply, deeply honored that the legislature has recognized the accomplishments of Charles Britton Maxey and his contributions to Oregon's civil rights movement. And I thank you for the opportunity.
Thank you. Any questions? Representative Berger.
I don't have a question, but I just have a comment. It looks to me like he came here, came to Portland at age 25. Not only left a legacy with human rights, but raised five children, was in business, politically active, and a good family person. And you don't get any better than that in my book. So I didn't know him, but I'm very, very happy to share with you as you celebrate his life.
Thank you so much for those comments, Mr. Chairman, Representative Berger. Thank you so much.
Representative Backlund.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Again, a comment, too. Senator, I think, probably remembers that I was a longtime U.S. history teacher, and I found history to be a vehicle to focus on people. People made things happen in most cases, and nothing is more interesting than people, and nothing is more important than what people can do. So it's really nice for me to hear about this gentleman and about his contributions, and I thank you for bringing it to our attention.
Absolutely.
Anything further? All right.
I would add one other last thing. If any of you ever have the opportunity, Mr. Chair and members of the committee, to be in the presence of former Senator Mark Hatfield, ask him about Charles Maxey and his legacy in the community. He has a lot of stories, and he loves to share them. Thank you.
Thank you. No one further scheduled to testify on this. Appreciate your testimony, Senator. We will close the public hearing on Senate Concurrent Resolution 7 and open up a work session on SCR 7. Ms. Horse?
Mr. Chair, I move Senate Concurrent Resolution 7 to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Flores has moved Senate Concurrent Resolution 7 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Any discussion? Call roll, please.
Representative Backlund?
Aye.
Representative Barnhart?
Aye.
Representative Close?
Aye.
Representative Forrest.
Aye.
Representative Alexander.
Aye.
Representative Ruger.
Aye.
Chair Wilson.
Chair votes aye, and we'll have Representative Monis Anderson carry the bill to the floor.
Mm-hmm.
And that closes the work session on SCR 7, and now open up a public hearing on Senate Bill 899, and ask Representative Rosenbaum and Senator Brown to come forward. And we expect Senator Tootie, Representative Tootie Smith to come forward. She comes over from the committee.
Okay. Good afternoon, Mr. Chair, committee members. For the record, State Senator Kate Brown representing Senate District 21. You have before you Senate Bill 899. We very much appreciate you giving this bill a hearing, and we encourage you to move it into work session and pass the bill. It's a very simple piece of legislation. There is a company in Southeast Portland, of which I represent, by the name of Irwin Hobson, and they have been making license plates since before I was born, 1917. Last year, the company lost this state's contract to a company located in Nova Scotia, Canada. And this bill has two components. It moves the license plate language into the public printing statute, therefore allowing any state company a 10% in-state company a 10% advantage in the bidding process. And it also requires ODOT to put the state's license plate bid up for contract in 2003. You will see that this bill received not unanimous but solid support in the Senate. It will increase the likelihood that the Portland-based Irwin Hobson Company will get the bid for manufacturing Oregon, My Oregon license plates. And with our unemployment rate being very high, it seems only natural that we as a legislature should do everything possible to make sure that, that jobs in Oregon stay in Oregon. So I'd be happy to answer any questions, and I thank you very much for giving this bill a hearing.
Representative Rosenbaum.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, I'm Representative Diane Rosenbaum, representing House District 42 in Southeast Portland, and I can tell you that I drive right by this company, this printing plant, every day on my way to Salem, Irwin Hobson. Indeed, as Senator Brown said, is a very old company. It's a 109 years old Portland company. So it was extremely unfortunate to learn that they had lost this work and had it go across the border to Canada. It's a relatively small number of jobs, but these are union family wage jobs, and we can get them back, and that's the good news that's presented to us in Senate Bill 899. This issue originally did arise, as Representative Close will remember, in the Business, Labor, and Consumer Affairs Committee, and I want to applaud her work on it as well as Representative Judy Smith, who really championed this issue. You know, it is a terrible time for our state in terms of massive unemployment, and when there is something we can do that's this simple to bring some work back, and this doesn't automatically bring it back, but it at least gives the Portland company a fighting chance at bidding on this contract and getting the work back, then I think that's exactly the thing we need to do. You'll see me wearing a sticker here that says Hire Oregon First, which was from a rally a couple of days ago about other ways that we can make sure that we maximize our tax dollars and use them to create jobs, good family-wage jobs in Oregon. So this bill is one example of that. I thank you, Mr. Chair, for hearing it today, and I hope it will move expeditiously to the floor.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm Representative Tootie Smith from Malala, House District 18. Colleagues, this bill has been very, very long coming. We started working on this probably last November when one of the first interim committees was heard. However, I started working on it probably in September, October, after reading the Oregonian headline that Oregon license plates would now be made not only out of state but out of country. And I read that, and I think we were finishing up our fifth special session at the time, thinking, how absurd can we be in this state to lay off people by sending a contract over state? Well, to make a long story short, the bill that came through the House on the license plate, so you'll remember that we all voted on, said that we needed to consider the economic conditions when sending jobs out of state. And that would be people going out on unemployment rolls, possibly qualification of Oregon Health Plan, et cetera. Well, the big irony of this thing, after it passed the House, it went over to the Senate, and the governor had shown interest in it, and he, like myself, had been concerned about this during the election cycle, and this situation was on his mind, too. So we sat down with the governor, and we came up with a solution that we thought would work. And so the bill was totally rewritten, but to our satisfaction as well, because when we were considering which way to go on this bill, we didn't know whether we should have the license plate contract be considered redefined as printing, which at the time when we held our committees back in November was extremely controversial, or to take a look at the economic impact. So we said, fine, that would work. Have license plates considered as printing. The big controversy at the time is because it didn't qualify as printing. This is what the printing looks like. It's an embossing. It's a film that goes over a plate. And I think most of you in the House and possibly the Senate were delivered one of these in your offices to remind us what we're trying to do down this session. I think it's very important that this contract stays within the state of Oregon. Now, this is a company that not only hires people to invest in our workforce, but they, like my good representatives have said, have been in Oregon for 109 years. And what that means is they have invested in technology. We no longer use a paint can and a paintbrush to make license plates. Things are computer automated. And so they have made huge investments in their infrastructure to keep Oregon viable. This company also makes license plates for other states who don't have either their prisoners do it in their own state or a company of their own. So this is a company that I would like to stay in Oregon. Now, furthermore, it's come to my attention that I'm deeply distressed and troubled at. You may hear from a lobbyist today who has been hired by the Nova Scotia Canada to dispel any of the economic considerations that we have brought to you today. I have discussions with that lobbyist, and I told him that I considered him to be completely out of line and out of order in working for the lobbyists from Canada. I think it's probably very easy in these times to be paid a lot of money to offer a testimony when it may not be actual or factual, and I am deeply distressed by testimony you may hear on those grounds. You'll also hear from the Portland Company and what this means to them to keep the jobs in Oregon. And now, committee, we have had very few jobs bills come across either the floor of the House or the Senate. This is something that I take seriously. I wish that this company was in my district, but it's not in my district. But these are important jobs. They need to stay in Oregon, and I would appreciate an aye vote.
All right. Any questions?
Mr. Chair.
Representative Close.
We have a -1 amendment, and there is some discussion about whether we need the amendment or not, so I'd like to get your perspective on this contract. It looks like it's a year-to-year contract. It expires in October 2003 is what it implies. Do any of you, can you offer an opinion on that?
Mr. Chair, Representative Close, I believe I had those amendments drafted. It was my understanding that the governor was not going to be very excited about signing the bill without those amendments. I think after additional information, he is at least willing to consider the bill without the amendments. I would encourage you not to adopt the -1 amendments. I did want to add, in terms of cost, there are a number of states that make that have the license plates cost. I would just let you know that Oregon is the 15th least expensive per plate. We're in the bottom third in terms of license plate expenses. New Hampshire is the cheapest at 44 cents, and New York is the most expensive at $3.90 per plate. Oregon's price is $1.30 per plate. I think folks from Canada can probably make the case that there is minor savings by these plates being made in Canada. We would argue that with the savings of 15 jobs, keeping those jobs in Oregon are worth the cost. So, thank you.
Mr. Chair, if I could interject too. I believe you'll hear testimony from the company makes that it's a difference of 2 cents per license plate, which to me is very worthwhile keeping the jobs here in Oregon. If the committee were to adopt the amendments, I would say don't even pass the bill. because the reason we are offering this bill is to keep jobs here. That would further put the contract out for bid for 5 years, my understanding. So I'm asking that you also please do not adopt the amendments.
Follow up?
Yeah, it's still unclear to me. Is this a year-to-year contract?
I believe the way it was written was the contract was awarded and then it comes up for rebid every year.
Thank you.
I think we'll get some clarification on that from some other folks. Any other questions? All right. Thank you for your testimony. Grover Simmons.
Chairman, members of the committee, good afternoon. My name is Grover Simmons. I represent the Pacific Printing and Imaging Association, but more particularly the Irwin-Hodson Company, which has been alluded to by the three previous witnesses. Every single point, Mr. Chairman, that I was going to make in my written testimony has been covered more ably than I could. Just trying to think of a couple of additional things, how this bill, one other explanation of how the bill came about. You recall that in the House, when the subject was introduced, it was House Bill 2846, and that bill dealt with computing the economic impact of losing the work to Canada. And that was the original bill that was in Representative Close's committee. That passed the House 53-4. Then on the Senate side, as Representative Smith indicated, she and I were asked to come to the governor's office because they really didn't like the to have to compute the economic impact of a bid. So they said, if you will consider and agree with a different procedure, then the governor will be able to support that particular part of the bill. And so they said, if you will put this subject in the public printing statute, then the governor will support that point. And we agreed, and the governor's office had the amendments drafted, and then Senator Brown had it all introduced in Senate Bill 899. And that bill passed the Senate on a 28-2 vote. There was a reference to the rollover, whether this is a one-year contract or a multiple-year contract. It is a one-year contract with the option with the Department of Transportation to roll it over for up to four additional years. So it could be a loss of work for Oregon for a total of 5 years, but it is a one-year contract. With respect to the number of jobs that have been lost and so forth, when we testified on this subject in December of last year, the projection at that time was that at least 15 jobs and perhaps more would be lost if this work truly went to Canada. And we had the company's accountant run a whole set of figures determining the amount of taxes and wages and workers' comp and unemployment insurance and all of those issues that are part of the economic impact. And well, subsequent to that time, as of just a moment ago, I've learned that 10 people have in fact lost their jobs. That's a sad commentary. It didn't reach 15, which was the projection clear back in December, but it has reached 10. And nobody's saying what might occur in the future, but 10 jobs lost is just a sad story, and all of that was unnecessary. The
Mr. Simmons,
yes.
And those 10 jobs are directly related to the loss of this license plate?
They are. Yeah, Mr. Chairman, they are related. The president of the company showed me a list a little while ago, and besides the name, there's production. One was an office person, and the rest are production employees. So they were directly related to this particular work, I'm told.
How many people does this company employ?
There are 30 people in the metals division, and the major company is a printing company. It's a large commercial printing company, and I don't know how many are in that total employment, but there are 30 people in the metals division.
Can you give us an estimate on the total employees of this company?
Maybe 85 to approximately 85, just a ballpark guess, but I could ask Mr. T.J. McDonald, who's in the audience, exactly how many, if you wish that information. Mm-hmm. So, the final point, there are only two companies in North America which manufacture, in a private sector, which manufacture license plates. One, of course, is of Portland, and the other one is Nova Scotia, Canada. And in view of the fact that we're looking as a state at 8.5% unemployment, it seems like a better public policy to try to bring this work back. This bill puts the subject in the public printing statute, and it doesn't guarantee, however, that the work will come back to Oregon. It only indicates that it will be put out to bid. So it will be another opportunity to bid on this work this year. But it doesn't guarantee that it will return to Oregon. Thank you very much, Mr. Chairman.
Okay. Representative Moss Anderson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Do you know what the contract was prior to it being awarded to Nova Scotia? What the contract was for? How much?
No, I don't know that. But the president of the company is here with that written data, which I just saw before the meeting.
He has that information will be helpful.
Sure.
If he can come forward.
It's Mr. T.J. McDonald is the president. He's here.
Mr. McDonald, you can come forward.
They were $3 a pair, and now they're $2.60. So there's a 40-cent difference.
My question was: is when the state of Oregon went into developed a contract with you, what was your bid, or what was the contract, or how much did the state of Oregon pay you to produce the license plates?
Mr. Chair and Representative Mona Sanderson, this current bid that we're talking about, I thought your question dealt with prior bids, but the current contract $2,065,000 for Canada, and $2,845,000 for Oregon, and the difference is $145,000. Right?
6.5% difference.
And it's a 6.5% and 2 cents a plate translates into 2 cents per plate.
Which is a little misleading in itself, because those numbers are actually twice what the actual usage will be. I assume that they, when they put out the contract, that they do it trying to plan for the biennium. So in essence, the actual use for the state is going to be probably more like 1.4. So it's a little misleading.
And I need you to state your name for the record.
T.J. McDonald.
Thank you. Okay. Further questions? All right. The piece about the on the bill that has the 10% differential.
Yes.
That's assuming a competitive bid situation. So I guess that would assume that the Canadian company would still, since that's the only other private company in the world that would be bidding on this.
Yeah, but actually, and there's been testimony given, there's prisons have bid the Oregon contract as well. There are a few prisons that are allowed to do that. And I believe Iowa this time actually bid it, but they were the high bidder.
Okay. With the option, for instance, if it goes this direction and then the Canadian company then has a decision to make of its own whether they want to bid again, mm-hmm. You have no competition. what's to keep you from just jacking up the prices to whatever you choose to if you have no competition?
Well, actually it allows anybody in Oregon to bid the contract, so, you know.
You're the only company that does this, right?
Well, it's embossing equipment, though. It's conventional equipment that could easily have dies put in it in two dozen shops in the state. So if you took that posture, you got to bet somebody's going to be in there sooner or later saying that, hey, we'll do it for considerably less. I can't explain the Canadian difference other than the value to the dollar. I know what the raw material costs are that go into these contracts, and, you know, hey, his pricing's right there. Mm-hmm. So given, you know, if you're asking me whether you think I can prevail to get it again, I don't know. I'm doing everything I can to, you know, keep my business going.
So, well, but I guess on the other side, if you have no competition, there's nothing to stop you from basically you know, giving any price you choose, and then it's up to the taxpayers to have to just put that bill to.
Yeah, first we wouldn't do that because I believe you guys would then say, well, let's look at prison industries like 41 other states in the United States do. I mean, we don't operate that way. You know, there's been testimony given that we were overpricing the marketplace before with the state. I think the word gouged was used in one of these committee hearings. Well, in fact, you heard earlier testimony saying that we're 15th in the pricing structure in the country prior to this bid. I'd be willing to say with the price now that Oregon has from the Canadian company that it's much lower than even 15th. So, I don't know how to answer you. We don't operate any of our businesses that way. And if you do, somebody's going to jump into the competitive circle with arena with you and float a better price to this day.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, they're public bids.
Right. And I guess there's always that potential that somebody else could jump in, but right now it's just you. And just looking, for instance, at the 2.665, if all of a sudden you've got, the 2.665 that the Canadian contract was, you've got all of a sudden 10% leeway there.
Yeah, which all due respect would be 4% given the price swing of the last bid. So, you know, I mean, 4% difference in pricing to me isn't a heck of an advantage for anybody.
Well, I guess I'm looking. Well, point taken. Here, you get an additional 4% off of what you've
right.
just bid. And how is it that the layoff of the 10 people just happened recently, and it didn't? You didn't have to lay off right when you lost the contract.
Again, Mr. Chairman, by testimony, that division of our company is small. It's 30 people. Well, it's one-third of the workforce. So, you know, if you're asking me, was Oregon's business one-third of the volume? Pretty close, in the 20s. I wouldn't swear to 22% or 24%, but right in that category. So, you know, the jobs go with the work. The reason it's just happened, which we've given testimony to earlier as well, is the contract actually has a lap over, and, you know, we held the people as long as we possibly could, and in fact we do no Oregon plates as of this date at all, none. So, hey, we don't have the work, we don't have the people.
And Mr. Simmons testified earlier, your total employees for your company is around 85?
Yeah, about 85.
Okay. Other questions? Representative Barnhart.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm not sure which of you this question is for, but I understand the governor doesn't like the idea of looking at economic impact, but I think as we think about what our decision ought to be on this bill, it's reasonable for us to think about it at least in rough terms, and I'm assuming that your business, when it's profitable, pays taxes in Oregon, and that the 10 employees you laid off also pay taxes in Oregon when they're working. Any idea what that comes to as a percentage of this contract?
Mr. Chair and Representative Barnhart, could I talk to the first part of the question, namely the economic impact? The governor's office said it's basically cumbersome to have to calculate the economic impact. And I think they were probably influenced by maybe the Department of Purchasing Department or Transportation. And so they really recommended this other procedure, which when you utilize the public printing statute, that gives Oregon, all Oregon companies which print public works have a 10% advantage. That 10% came out of a lawsuit. It's a rule of thumb that the department uses, but it came out of a lawsuit like 30 or 40 years ago when John Chamberlain was a state printer, and that has been used by the government as a rule of thumb over these many years to keep printing work in Oregon. So by putting this subject in that statute, that triggers the 10% formula. It's not a statutory formula, but the governor's office says, as a matter of faith, they would stay with that. So we took them at their word. The second part of your question dealt with the size, the value of the economic impact. Trying to get those numbers back in mind. I remember the testimony was that there's a difference of $145,000, and then we had the company bookkeeper do the calculations of the lost taxes, workers' comp and employment insurance, and the projection that some of those people would be on the Oregon Health Plan. And instead, and I remember the punchline, instead of saving $145,000, we were going to pay a Canadian company $88,430 to take our work. I testified to that point in an earlier hearing, and frankly, since the subject has been transferred into a whole different statute, I didn't have that in today's testimony. I thought it would just get us bogged down in numbers. But the essence of your question is answered. We're going to pay a Canadian company to take public work from Oregon when you compute the economic impact. Now, that those numbers were developed on the projection that 15 people would be laid off, and actually only 10 have been laid off
so far.
So it's all kind of a fluid situation. But none of it's good. Laying off anybody is from a manufacturing job in Oregon is not a good situation.
Representative, those are also hard dollars he's talking about. That's no consideration whatsoever for $1.4 million, using my math, half of the number, or use the state's number, the 2.6, times 5 years, which they have the option to do, out of the Oregon economy. Now, I don't mean moving from Southeast Portland to Northeast Portland. I mean the dollars are gone. So they're not spent at the theater, and they're not spent at the restaurant. They're not spent here.
Right. Thank you. If I may, that hearing was the work group on ORS 279, if I remember correctly, and I was impressed at that time by those numbers. Even if you're down to 10 instead of 15, we're still talking about breaking even at best.
Yeah.
On the hard dollars, if I understand you correctly.
Mm-hmm. Correct.
Thank you. Further questions?
Mr. McDonald, just curious on the looking at other states that have, maybe even have contracts with other states, license plates. Is there any kind of reciprocity issues if now all of a sudden Oregon is imposing this kind of 10% preference for you? Is there?
It's done state by state, and I have not looked, so I can't answer your question.
How many other contracts with other states do you have?
We have right now Missouri, Alaska, Hawaii, Mississippi. And as far as volume, obviously, Mississippi's the big one. Mississippi, luckily, we landed before the Oregon contract was taken from us, or probably the viability of that company still being here and me sitting here would not be one.
Okay, so, I mean, just with seeing four other states that you have, how maybe you can explain why you had to let go a third of your staff when you...
It's all on volume. Yeah, I mean, you know, it's Oregon and Mississippi, from a volume standpoint, are four times what Alaska, Hawaii, and Missouri are. Because Missouri, we actually don't do the whole contract. We do a sub out from the prison industries there.
Okay. Further questions? All right. Thank you for your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you very much.
Harvey Matthews and Tim Nesbitt, please.
Members of the committee, thank you very much for hearing Senate Bill 899. I want to come representing Associated Oregon Industries, Oregon's largest business association, in support of Senate Bill 899 without the Dash 1 amendments. Practically, this saves Oregon jobs. It puts money in the hands of Oregonians and helps fund state services through the use of the income tax. And this is also a very important bill symbolically. It represents government making every effort possible to understand the long-term impact of financial decisions on Oregon jobs. For those two reasons and everything else that you've heard from prior testimony, I want to once again support this bill as written. Thank you.
Mr. Nesbitt.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I'm Tim Nesbitt, president of the AFL-CIO in Oregon. We, too, see this bill as a jobs bill, which impacts most immediately 10 good jobs with health care and pensions, and long-term, the fate of a manufacturer here trying to compete in the traded sector, which, as you've heard in many cases before, is one of our top priorities for economic development strategies in this state. Manufacturing jobs are our best-paying jobs, those most likely to provide family benefits as well. And I would submit that at a time when we're attempting to use every means at our disposal to keep good jobs here in Oregon, including the use of taxpayer subsidies to attract new employers and new jobs, that it just fails a common sense test to terminate the state's purchases and with this company and force the elimination of these much-needed good jobs in our state. In effect, we're willing to pay employers to locate here, but we're not willing to pay even a pittance more to purchase the products that sustain good jobs already here. SB 899 offers the opportunity, at a cost of 2 cents per plate, to put Made in Oregon back on our license plates here in Oregon and restore as many as 10 good-paying jobs. And I had a conversation over the phone yesterday with one of the workers who was laid off. He collected unemployment benefits for 1 week, and then he went and took a temporary job paying $7 an hour with no benefits. He's still looking for a better job. He's lost his health insurance, and he has two young children. He's the kind of worker we'd like to see back in a job that supports his family with good benefits. Again, this bill simply offers the opportunity for this company to compete more effectively and maintain these kinds of jobs in Oregon. Thank you.
Questions? Representative Close.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Nesbitt, I don't know if you know the answer to this, but we know that Canada heavily subsidizes some of their industries, like forest products. Do you know if they subsidize other industries or if there's any subsidy for this type of industry?
Mr. Chair and Representative Close, I do not. I suspect that if Mr. McDonald had the resources, he could perhaps wage a claim under the NAFTA or the WTO to kind of get to that. What are the hidden subsidies here? He and I discussed that just about a month ago. He does not have the resources to pursue a claim like that. But we suspect, you know, the health care costs in Canada, for instance, are socialized, not borne by any one employer. That's a key distinction already, and you heard my story about the importance of health care benefits in this workforce. So I can't give you a definitive answer on that, but we have our suspicions.
Thank you.
Further questions? Representative Berger?
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chairman. It really pleases me to see both of you here to speak in favor of this bill. Actually, I'm in favor of something much broader than this. But I guess this, I could say, was a start. I think we have made decisions that have caused us to have some of the high unemployment that we have. Some of it we couldn't have prevented, but there's some that we could have. And I think we need to really look at that, and I think that jobs should be at the top of our list in the legislature because it is at the top of the list of the people outside of this building. And I think that it's a real good thing to have you here, and I strongly support you.
Further questions? Mr. Nesbitt, what do you think about the concern just about creating a monopoly, allowing one company to have this kind of a preference, basically driving out competition, and then what impact that may be, maybe not in the first contract, but later on as the prices continue to escalate without anybody to compete against them? And then, too, the comment made by Mr. McDonald that ultimately this might then cause the state to have to turn to our prison industry to be printing license plates.
Mr. Chair, from the testimony I heard prior to mine and from my reading of the bill, this does not eliminate competition. It simply provides a little extra consideration for an in-state manufacturer. And that's based on the value to our economy, to our state, of sustaining good jobs. I think it's the same kind of value that motivates us to go out and recruit importers, and I would hope that we can provide that kind of extra consideration, but not an elimination of competition by any means.
When there's only two people or two companies competing, I mean, are you suggesting that you just expect the Canadian company to continue competing?
It sounds like the Canadian firm is competing successfully, and it's just when we don't take into account the impact on our own economy and our own workforce to the extent that we're being willing to give a 10% consideration, as we already do for our printing, mm-hmm. which makes a lot of sense because it keeps jobs here in Oregon, then I think we're not taking care of our own.
And to the issue of prison industries taking this over? Ultimately, if it becomes too costly?
Well, it sounds like they're a competitor, not one we would encourage. Obviously, those are not good jobs.
Okay. Thank you. Other questions? All right. Thank you for testimony. Tim Martinez.
Good afternoon. Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, for the record, Tim Martinez here today on behalf of Waldale Manufacturing, the other guy that you've heard so much about from the previous folks. Despite what my good friend Representative Smith said, I clearly misbid this when I got this contract yesterday and did not realize the power that was lined up on the bill. Having said that, I would like to say a few things if I might. In 2001, which was the last time this went out to bid without any competition, Irwin Hodson bid approximately $3.8 million for the contract. The next year, when there was going to be competition, their bid dropped to 2.8. So they lowered their bid $1 million in 1 year. I would be hard-pressed. Maybe they can suggest technology changes or something that allowed them to drop their bid $1 million. But the fact of the matter is, once competition was brought into play, there was a significant reduction in the bid. Had they got the bid in without any competition, the state would have ended up paying roughly $6 million more over the five-year term of the contract. And as you've heard, it is a one-year contract with 4 years' worth of renewals. So I do believe there is obviously another side to this particular issue. And I guess one of the points I would ask you to consider, and Mr. Chairman, I guess at the end of the day, I have one simple question. I believe that there needs to be an answer to the question about what happens to the Oregon transportation package if this bill were to be passed and if the Oregon producer would get the contract at roughly what they had last time. It's my understanding that in the transportation package, there is a net amount that goes from the production of license plates. And that amount is going to shrink if you are paying higher production costs for the plates. I believe representatives from the DMV are present in the room, and it's my understanding that that could be $600,000 in loss to cities and counties for these road projects that we're now trying to put in place to help stimulate our economy. I don't think there's anybody in the room, and I know the committee is very concerned about the economy and wants to see the economy turn around, and we all do. But there are some costs to this proposal. I was listening to Representative Verger, and as she knows, you know, many of her cars on her own dealerships are produced in Canada, manufactured in Canada. So we've had a long history of working with our Canadian partners to the north. And I think this sends a bad message, not just to Canada, but to other states that might look at putting similar preferences on products that Oregon ships out of state. I would be happy to answer any questions. I would just, you know, close with one thought. If I understood the folks from Irwin Hobson, they picked up the contract in Mississippi roughly the same time they lost the contract for Oregon. These two companies bid back and forth on these nine states and in international and other places. Sometimes they win, sometimes they lose. My client lost in Mississippi, I believe recently lost in Missouri, but it's very clear when you look at the numbers that this is a good deal for Oregon, this particular contract. So I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Any questions? Representative Close?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Martinez, when these bills that were similar were in the House Business, Labor, and Consumer Affairs Committee, there was no testimony from the company in Canada opposing them. Do you know why that was?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Close, again, this is a new contract for me. I do not believe they had representation in the building at that point. Should they have? Probably. Tudy, Representative Smith has made that very clear that she thinks they should have been in the building from day one. I can't, you know, adjust that. They made a decision now to hire the contract. And I would, if I may, Mr. Chairman, Representative Close, I will find out the answer to your question about if there is any Canadian subsidies for this particular. My guess is when you're talking one company, you know, in each country that's doing this, there's probably not anything there, but I will find that out for you.
Follow up?
Sure, follow up.
Well, I guess I'd be interested in, you know, like the raw material source and if there's a subsidy there made. When the bills were before my committee, we had testimony that there are very old statutes, Oregon statutes, that in the old days they did require that Oregon businesses be used whenever possible in different areas. What's your opinion on that?
Mr. Chair, Representative Close, I'm here representing this on a very specific issue. Not, you know, I think my opinion on that probably wouldn't be important to this particular bill.
Representative Monica Anderson.
I think I had the question answered. Your company that you're representing in Nova Scotia gets their raw materials from Canada, whereas the company here gets their raw materials within the United States.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Monica Anderson, I will find out the answer to that. I don't know where they get their raw materials.
And also, do you know where the... The contract that we have is 1 year renewable every year, or is it the 5 years?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Moss Anderson, it's my understanding that it's a one-year contract with four-year renewals. And those are generally, at the discretion of the state. I've had conversations with DMV. They are very pleased, and they're here, they can speak for themselves, but they tell me they are very pleased with the contract results. They have no issues with them, and notwithstanding this bill, they would more than likely go ahead and renew if this bill were not to become law. There's no doubt that the Oregon companies have these contracts for a long time, and for a long time there were no bids. I would just argue that the state is netting to the positive, even with the job losses, and obviously my client is not necessarily convinced that those job losses are due to this one particular contract, since they picked up a contract of similar numbers at the same time they lost this one.
The reason I'm asking that, I was just wondering, not having the contract in front of us, I assume there wouldn't be any if we did not renew with I forget the name of the company, the Nova Scotia company. Mm-hmm. Litigation wouldn't be an issue due to the wording. do there have to be certain reasons why you wouldn't renew? I mean,
Mr. Chairman, Representative Moe Sanderson, I certainly wouldn't want to give the committee any legal advice. Again, DMV's here. It's my understanding that what would happen is that they would go ahead and give my client a continuing contract while they rebid. At that point, if the Oregon company was successful, that contract would then be terminated and a new one would start up with the Oregon company.
Representative Berger.
Yes. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. You're right. We have cars made everywhere, and I don't make that decision. However, I do want to point out the difference in the private sector and the public sector, and the fact that when we're making decisions about how money is spent for the state, we're talking about money that comes into our coffers by way of the people in Oregon. And so consequently, there is a real strong nexus between the money that we have in our budgets and the money that is in the private sector. So,
Mr. Chairman, Representative Verger, you're absolutely correct. I guess I would just add, though, again, that you were looking at a contract that in 2001 was bid at $3.8 million, and once competition entered, it was reduced by over $1 million a year. I mean, that's a significant amount. And, you know, it is the people's money, and I think they have a right to expect that it is being spent at an appropriate level,
either
inside or outside of Oregon.
I agree with you, and that's the first time that I've heard that. I do think that there is a way, however, that can be managed, and I think that we need to look at that very closely. That's the first time that I heard that number.
Well, Mr. Chairman, I'll just close with again saying that it's my understanding that the DMV is happy with the contract. DAS has found this company easy and have had no issues with them as far as administering the contract, and would ask that the committee carefully consider 899, and if nothing else, if we can get the answer on the transportation package, if indeed there is a $600,000 hit to the transportation package to cities and counties, I would strongly request that you send it down to Ways and Means so they can factor in that number as they finish up their budget process.
Further questions to Ms. Martinez? Ms. Martinez, I'm trying to, maybe it's the DMV folks that need to answer this, but I'm kind of thinking this through. I didn't vote for this bill in its original form, but I didn't vote for all the pork that was in the transportation package either. So yet, you know, I look at you know, a potential impact on what we're trying to achieve with that transportation package that passed out. Can you give more information on that?
Well, Mr. Chairman, again, what I would like to do is, maybe with your direction, have a letter sent to DMV and let them flesh that out, because I've had some preliminary conversations with them, and I think they could flesh it out a little bit better for you as to how this number, how they come up with the number, and what impact it would have on cities and counties.
All right.
But that would be my next step, with your permission.
All right. Kelly Taylor, can you come forward?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Kelly Taylor with the Department of Transportation.
Hi, Kelly. Can you just kind of help us with this? I mean, where the issue is, especially on the transportation funding, as it would relate to potential higher costs for the license plates, and then while you're here, if you have some comments about working with the Canadian company over this past year, you can provide that as well.
Certainly, Mr. Chair. Let me answer the first question about the transportation package. In House Bill 2041, there's a variety of fees and things that are in there funding the different pieces of the package. One of them is the plate manufacturing fee. And that language is now, I don't remember the exact fees, but they're set fees now. I think it's $3 or $4 for a single plate and $6 for a pair of plates that we would collect. And what I think Mr. Martinez is trying to explain is the higher, and those fees, the amount that we collect that's over the cost of manufacturing is dedicated to cities and counties. They're part of the package. So if the cost of plates goes up to us, the money transferred out of that towards cities and counties would come down because the delta, the excess would be shrinking. And if you look at just the 2002 bids, and if you just use those numbers as a base, and that's really the only time we've had competition for years and years and years and years, so I'm just, and there, it's new, so it's just a year ago. The difference in a biennia between those two bids is about $370,000. So if you took those two bids and said, okay, if this law were in place and those bids came in just the way they were last time, the costs would go up $370,000. Yes, Erwin Hodgson would get the contract because it would be within 10%, but $370,000 that would have gone to cities and counties won't because the cost has gone up. Now, because there's a 10% differential that could happen, that's where the potential of $591,000 is, because the difference between those two contracts, 10% over biennium, would be about $591,000. So even if that exact, you know, if those numbers came in, or knowing you've got a 10% leeway to play with when you're doing your numbers, that is the potential hit. Just the contracts, the way they came in, the bids came in, would be $370,000, but the potential is $591,000. And so that money would be coming out, would be retained by us to cover the cost of plate, so it would not be going to cities and counties. And the plate manufacturing fee is one of the fees going to cities and counties. Now, to answer your question as far as the service provided in the past year, it has been very satisfactory. The delivery time has been comparable, even though they're on the, you know, far end of the country, and the product has been very, very good, excellent, and so we've had no problems with the contract so far.
If the just the fact that it is it's an annual contract that's subject to renewal every year.
Mm-hmm.
Even if you're totally satisfied with this Canadian company, you can still make that decision to open the bid up again, can you not? I mean, do you actually need cause to, I guess, cease the contract with the other company?
Mr. Chair and members, I don't have it memorized in my head, and I'm not a contract attorney, but my understanding is, yes, we could make the decision to simply go back out for bid. We have not done so in the 70-some years under contract with Erwin Hodgson, and every year if it came around and everything was going good, we renewed it. But you're right. I don't believe we have to have cause. I believe we can just simply go back out for bid.
And
there's never been need to, because the service was good, and the service right now is good.
Would that just be a decision by your director, by the governor? Where does that decision come from?
Mr. Chair, I believe that comes from within the department.
Okay.
That answers the question.
Okay. Other questions? Representative Ackland.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Kelly, you made a comment that the quality of service that you've experienced with the Canadian company is good.
Yes.
And the product itself is of high quality.
Yes.
But would that be comparable then? Or in other words, was Erwin Hodgson also providing good service, and was the quality of its plates comparable?
Mr. Chair and Representative Backlund, I think Erwin Hodgson did a good job, and I think that they put out a good product. When I talked with DMV, they didn't give me specific categories, but I did ask, because I was asked and didn't know the answer, and I heard that they were that the Canadian company was equal to or better than what we had gotten from Erwin Hodgson, at least in one category, but I don't know the specifics of which category that is.
Thank you.
Okay. Any further questions? All right. Thank you.
Appreciate
your testimony. There's no one further else scheduled to testify. Anybody else interested? Okay, close the public hearing on SB 899. And colleagues, I want to take a little bit of time on this, but I will guarantee our representative we will still bring this back. But I didn't want to. A couple of issues that just came up that I'm interested in pursuing a little bit more. Now we can open up a work session on Senate Bill 7. Colleagues, Senate Bill 7 is the State Fair Foundation bill that we've had a couple of discussions on already in public hearing, and one issue that was left for us to consider was the -A6 amendments, which are before you or in your file. And that's establishing the emergency clause on top of the other amendments that we had already put in the bill. And if we can get the -A6 adopted, then we can move the bill to the floor. Council Forrest?
Mr. Chair, I would move adoption of the -A6 amendments to Senate Bill 7.
Council Forrest moves adoption of the -A6 amendments to Senate Bill 7. Any discussion? Any objection? All right, so
ordered. Mr. Chair, I would move Senate Bill 7 to the floor as amended with a due pass recommendation.
Mr. Forrest moves Senate Bill 7 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Discussion, Representative Barnhart.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I would just like a quick review of what we have done so far.
Okay, what you would probably see in your file is the -5s, which were placed in the last work session we had on this bill to put some additional controls on, I guess, the relationship that the State Fair Agency may have with this new foundation or any other organization, I guess, that is used to provide grants or donations. Mm-hmm. And that has been where it was left.
And we did not adopt the A3s.
That's correct.
Okay. I'm ready. Thank you.
All right. Any further discussion? Call the roll, please.
Representative Backlund.
Aye.
Representative Barnhart.
Aye.
Representative Close.
Excused.
Representative Forrest.
Aye.
Representative Monsander.
Yes, aye.
Representative Berger.
Aye.
Chair Boyle.
Chair votes aye, and Representative Close is now here for the vote.
Representative Close.
Votes aye, thank you.
And Senate Bill 7 will is passed then to the floor with a due pass recommendation. And Representative Berger, you carry the bill?
Okay.
Great, thank you. Very good. All right. And now we can open up a public hearing on Senate Bill 260. Bring up. Let's just stand at ease for just a moment. And Senate Bill 260, we are looking for some help, I think, from the Insurance Division to help explain this bill. So I asked Joel Ario to come forward and just kind of give us a brief summary of what this bill is. This bill has come over from the House Business and Affairs Committee. It had been It came over one way from the Senate, had some amendments attached to it from the House Business Committee, and that's what you see before you in the B and Gross version.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, Joel Ario, Insurance Administrator with the Department of Consumer and Business Services. As the Chair explained, this bill originated in the Senate, where the Senate passed what could be called a categorical ban on the use of credit scoring in the personal lines of insurance. We're talking auto and homeowner. It came over to the House, and in the prior House committee, a compromise was crafted, and that compromise would, in essence, bar the use of credit scoring with existing customers, but allow the use of credit scoring with new business applicants. That compromise builds on something that our department had done by rule. We convened a process back in 2002 because we were hearing a lot of consumer complaints about credit scoring, and spent 18 months or so working with an advisory committee that included insurance companies, insurance agents, and consumer representatives. And out of that process, we developed a number of regulations of credit scoring. One of them was to prohibit, which was something that was at that time the major kind of consumer complaint we were hearing, which was people who'd been with a particular insurance company for some period of time, often with no claims history, losing their insurance entirely because of a bad credit history. And so in our rule-making procedure, we banned that particular procedure. We discussed banning rate increases for existing customers based on credit scoring too, but there was not a consensus to do that in the rulemaking process, and there was a pretty good argument that we really didn't have authority under current statutes to do it. So it stood in place that there would be use of credit scoring to both increase rates of both new and existing customers, and also to decide who got served in the insurance marketplace in the first place. That's kind of the posture came. The legislature, the Senate passed the full ban. By the time we got to the House, we were in weighing in on the side of saying that we heard enough complaints from existing customers about rate increases that we really did support the legislature at least going as far as to bar the use of credit scoring with existing customers for rate increases. And so that's kind of where the compromise is. We've also testified before, and we testify again today, that if the committee wants to pass a full ban, that that's a workable solution from our perspective too, and we could support that and we could implement that. So that, in essence, what you have before you is the compromise that, again, says for an existing customer, you cannot use credit history to penalize that customer, but for new business, you can continue to decide. For people you don't know a lot about, you can continue to use credit history as one of the variables that you consider in deciding whether to write an applicant at all, take them on, and also exactly what rate you're going to charge them. The bill does have some protections in that area, too, which you could get into if you wanted to, that are more technical in nature, but they include the fact that credit scoring can't be the only reason why you don't write somebody or the only reason why you charge them a high rate. It has to be used in combination with other, quote, substantive underwriting factors. So that comports, too, with what we think is good practice in the marketplace. This credit scoring, if it's going to be used at all, and it does get a lot of consumer complaints, it ought not to be used to the exclusion of the traditional underwriting factors. It ought to be used in conjunction with them, and this bill says that's how it should work, too. So I'll stop with that and be happy to answer questions.
Questions? Representative Close.
Mr. Chair, I just want to make one comment that this did come out of the Business, Labor, Consumer Affairs Committee, and this is the amount of testimony that we had on this bill. Just so the committee knows, that's why the compromise was reached.
Thank you. Other questions? Mr. Ario, on the issue of just allowing still credit scores to be used for new folks, can you kind of just delve a little bit more into the rationale? Maybe, I mean, and we could hear, I'm sure, from the industry folks just on the correlations even between credit scores and claims activity, but, and that does, you know, I'd be interested in your take on that too, but I guess I'm just as interested in hearing from you if you think that there's an issue as to, you know, maybe people having limits on competition or ability to go out to other companies. Basically, if they don't like the company they're with, that they don't have good credit, this basically hurts their chances of going somewhere else and starting fresh unless they have their credit scores reviewed.
Mr. Chairman, I think that's correct. This does have that. The compromise will leave those kind of problems in the marketplace. Somebody who has a bad credit history, who's going to therefore pay higher insurance rates because of that, will have a harder time moving from one company to another. So I think you're correct about that. The larger question of whether it should be used and so forth, from our perspective, we start with the basic rules that we apply. And the basic rules that we apply when an insurer submits a new rating factor, and it happens from time to time, and usually when insurers come up with new factors to use to decide who they're going to insure, how much they're going to charge, there's some controversy associated with it. What we look at is the actuarial evidence. We look at the statistical evidence for whether there is actually a correlation between where somebody lived and their likelihood of having an accident, or what kind of car they're driving and their likelihood of having an accident. And there are actuarial processes to determine whether there is the requisite statistical correlation to make the case. On that narrow basis, and I caution you, that's a narrow basis because I've been excoriated before for saying that our actuaries do find that there is that correlation, but the fact is that they do, that there is statistical correlation between people's credit histories and their likelihood of having an accident in the same way that there is for the other variables. So this passes that first test. Then for us, we look at whether it's used in balance with other factors and those sorts of things. But basically, if it passes that actuarial test and it's used in a reasonable way, our laws tell us to approve it. There is then the broader public policy question of whether it's a good idea. And there are things that are not allowed in insurance because the legislature, rather than the regulator in a technical sense, have decided that from a broader public policy perspective, it's not a good idea. Race. You could correlate race still with life insurance premiums because, on average, African Americans live shorter lives than Caucasians. So you could say, as an insurance company, we're going to charge them more for insurance because they die earlier. That is not allowed. I think every legislature in the country has made a decision on public policy grounds that is not a fair thing to do. And that's the debate that's in front of the legislature. Is it a fair thing or not for companies to use credit scoring as a variable, even if it works in the traditional insurance sense? Is it a fair thing or not? I think the compromise is a kind of reasonable solution. I think it does provide some protections. I will tell you that under the compromise, there will be pockets of problem that will continue to be there because, in general, the general public has two basic problems that we hear about a lot. One, they don't believe this correlation stuff. Probably several of you don't believe the actuaries when they say that it actually correlates. Things come to mind about where you can have a lot of things correlate. Who's elected president and who wins the Super Bowl correlate too, but just because they correlate statistically doesn't mean it's really a correlation. There are those kinds of concerns that the public have about it. My actuaries tell me they test it in a lot of very thorough ways that it actually does, but there's still that doubt in the public. So that's one. And then two, I think the other kind of argument that emerges about credit scoring is, it's kind of like, we don't have debtors' prisons in America, and we don't kick people when they're down in America, and this is kind of, to punish people for their credit history on their insurance is kind of just goes too far, they already have enough problems, and it's kind of just kicking people when they're down sort of thing. That gets said in one form or another by a lot of consumers that they call us. But on the flip side of that, I will tell you that if you eliminate credit scoring entirely, it doesn't benefit everybody. I mean, that will have winners and losers. Credit scoring is not something that causes rates to uniformly go higher. It simply causes some people to pay more and some people to pay less. So if you eliminate it, you will hear from a whole different group of people, which are the ones that currently benefit from it. And there's only one state in recent time, that's Maryland, that banned credit scoring, and when they did, the insurance companies, of course, blamed it all on the legislature, and so the letters that went out to people said, your rates are going up because the legislature prohibited us from giving you the rate we think you should get because you have good credit.
So then you had a series of complaints from those people. So there are, you know, that's the kind of thing that happens on the other side. And in the end, most states have come with some kind of compromises like ours. The compromise that's proposed here would put us in probably, you know, the somewhere around the 10th toughest set of regulations of credit scoring. If we did the ban, it would put us as the toughest state in the country on credit scoring. That gives you a sense of how other states. This issue has been hot in every legislature in the country this year, so there's been some action on it in every legislative session, I think, without fail, some kind of action. And so the compromise here is stronger than most of those actions, but it is not as strong as Maryland did. A couple of states have, Hawaii's had it banned since the early 70s, kind of by accident. They just prohibited use of all factors except the ones they allowed, and so by default this was prohibited, and nobody succeeded in undoing that yet. So credit scoring is not used in Hawaii. The market works okay. There's not been a big problem. And in California, because of Prop 103, again, it said, here's the factors you can use on auto, and credit scoring wasn't one of them because no one was doing this back in 1988. So it is banned in the auto market in California, and it hasn't caused any, you know, particular problem. The traditional factors work okay. So I don't think there's a good case that in the long run, you know, this is absolutely essential to the insurance industry to have this to succeed. But in the short term, if the more you go towards the ban side, the more you're going to get upheaval in the market. And that's what the chair and I have discussed before. I think I just bring that to your attention as the best argument against doing the ban is the upheaval. The best argument for it is that if you don't eliminate it, you're going to continue to get some angry consumers who just don't feel like it's fair to them to be punished on their auto insurance or their homeowner insurance because of bad credit history.
Is it your understanding that insurance companies uniformly apply credit scoring, or they apply it in different ways based on their own marketing and other business reasons?
Mr. Chairman, they apply it differently. In the banking world, there's basically one model that's used. It's the Fair Isaac model. And so when banks apply this in terms of mortgage lending and that sort of thing, there's just one standard model. In the insurance industry, there are many different models out there. I myself think that's a little oversold by the insurance industry because two things can't be true at the same time. It can't be that this really works wonderfully and is a great predictor, but two, we all do it completely differently too. So my guess is the differences are overstated and that the core variables that are being measured, if it works statistically, have to be pretty similar, but they're not exactly the same.
Question?
And then looking at I guess these the new folks, well, go back first on the renewals. And my guess is that's where your complaints are coming, because that's where mine are, and I think everybody else is. The folks that are getting the form letters that are actually, I think it's a, was that a administrative rule requirement or a statutory requirement that these letters go out when there's a change in rates for these customers, and they have to explain, you know, if credit scoring was one of the reasons for it.
Mr. Chairman, it starts with the federal requirement under the Federal Fair Credit Reporting Act. If there's an adverse decision based on credit, then it requires notification to the consumer of that. As part of our rule, we adopted that same standard under state law so that we could also enforce that standard. And so it's both a federal and a state requirement to give that adverse decision notice whenever there's an adverse decision. There's still some dispute about exactly what an adverse decision is, but that is the genesis of those letters. And then there's a broader argument there too, I think, which is if you have an existing customer, you know that customer, you know their claims history and that sort of thing, and so the argument that you treat them a little differently than you might treat a new customer is standard in the insurance business. Every insurance company has somewhat different procedures for how they handle existing books of business than they do new books. If they didn't, they probably have more trouble holding on to their current customers. So this distinction is important in a lot of different areas, and here it's sort of, you know, wait until the person has a claim. If you think they're going to be a bad risk, wait, you know, to preemptively take them out, put a new rate increase on them, or cancel their insurance because they might, based on some predictive model, have a problem. Wait until it happens, and if it happens, then treat them on that. So that's kind of the theory behind treating existing customers differently than new.
Thank you. Representative Close?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I want to address a couple of things that came out of my committee that our committee doesn't have access to. But one is this Bureau of Business Research Study, McComb School of Business, University of Texas at Austin, March 2003. And you're well versed in this, I believe, right?
Madam, Mr. Chairman, Representative Close, I've looked at the study. I don't know if well-versed would be accurate.
I want you to give me an opinion on it, but I want to refer you to this chart 4, which is not correlation, it's regression analysis. And what it says is, statistical analysis confirmed the visual relationship apparent in chart 4. A regression analysis of the relative loss ratio on credit score was highly significant. This indicates that there is less than a 1 in 10,000 chance that the relationship observed between credit score and relative loss ratio could be due to chance alone. Pretty persuasive. And it is done by University of Texas. So some people have said to me, well, you know, they question their figures, but these charts, visually at least, are pretty clear-cut. So what is your opinion on that?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Close, again, I think there's a virtual consensus in the actuarial community that the evidence is there for the correlation, for the statistical relationship between a bad credit score and the likelihood of having accidents. That a lot of people dispute that on common sense grounds, but the statistics are there. That's what that study's about, is statistics to measure that. And this regression analysis, in simple terms, is about this. There is a correlation between gray hair and wealth. You could establish that statistically. But someone would then come along and say, there's also with going bald and wealth. But the reason there is that correlation is not because the two things really correlate. It's because there's actually a correlation between age and wealth. And when you're older, and what they're measuring in this context is to say, that's what some people say about credit scoring. Well, yeah, it works. It's a statistical relationship, but it's really measuring some other variable. And the stuff that you just cited is about saying, we've looked at all the other variables through regression analysis, and none of them explain the correlation. So therefore, there's very little chance that this is one of those spurious correlations like gray hair and wealth. It's the real correlation. It's the real McCoy.
But yeah. 1 in 10,000 is a pretty high correlation, isn't it?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Close, yes. And again, I think the actuarial community is virtual consensus that the correlations are there. And so the real issue for the committee is not whether there's actually a correlation or not. The issue for the committee is, even if there is this one of those things that just because the technical people in insurance tell us that it works, we don't like it as a public policy matter. That's the issue that's in front of the committee.
Follow up, Mr. Chair.
Follow up.
The effect of our committee amendments had a lot to do with allowing the consumer with the unfavorable rating to request the insurer to reconsider, that they would have an appeals process, and that is beyond your current rules, is it not?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Close, there is provision in our rules for correction of mistakes in credit history.
But the appeal process.
I believe, I'm sorry, I'm a little rusty on some of the details, and I may have to get some help here, but I believe there's an appeal process in the bill that goes somewhat farther than what we had before.
Okay. Thank you.
Representative Moss-Anderson.
Thank you. How much weight does an insurance company give to a poor credit rating versus the type of car? I mean, there's a number of risk factors that they have, or whatever you call it, factors, rating factors that they use. Is this primarily the major one in, say, car insurance?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Moss-Anderson, no, it's a factor. We think it should be a factor. And this is one of the areas that when we review rates and look at what the insurance companies provide, we do on occasion find an insurance company that has not only wants to use credit scoring and shows us the correlation, but wants to slice and dice their marketplace into 30 I think we've seen as many as 30 different categories based on credit score, and we tend to say that's probably too many categories, and if somebody says we want to use this to the exclusion of all other variables, we'd raise questions about that too. So I'm not aware of any company that's eliminated territory and make of car and age of driver and some of the more common factors, but there clearly is an increase in use of this factor. Some states have tried to get at that and say you can only make it X percent factor, but it's very hard, it's very difficult to work with that kind of legislation because these models tend to be kind of dynamic between the various variables, and so they sort of artificially try to say, I think everybody wants to get to this point, if it's going to be allowed at all, it ought to be a factor, not too big a factor. Use it, but don't use it too much is kind of what almost every audience I address ends up, you know, concluding about it, and but it's kind of hard to express that in a legislative bill.
Follow-up? So when someone applies for insurance, they give their information, and basically it's a formula then, right? Is that how insurance companies do?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Montes Anderson, yes, more or less that's correct. On credit scoring, it tends to be a formula, and for a lot of companies, it tends to be even simplified down to a yes or no as to write the insurance put them in rate category 1 or category 2 or category 3, and all of the actual computation is done in computers behind the scenes, and all the agent sees is the bottom line decision on their computer screen. That more and more of that underwriting process is done in that kind of fashion.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Maybe a couple questions. First of all, a comment. I really wish there was a correlation between men who had gray hair or no hair and wealth. I'm not sure there is, and so we'll just skip that and get to the business here of Senate Bill 260. Earlier, Joel, you mentioned that if credit scoring were done away with, there would be winners and losers. Who would win? Who would be the bigger winners? What kind of numbers are you talking about? Would more insured benefit from doing away with credit scoring or fewer?
Madam Chair, I apologize for continuing. Mr. Chair up until this point, but Madam Chair, Representative Backlund, in general, credit scoring seems to follow the pattern of most insurance variables, which is the number of losers are smaller than the number of winners. Most variables fall on and hurt less than the majority of the people, a smaller number. So I think that's generally true of credit scoring, that the winners outpace the losers. And one of the political dynamics of the issue is that, of course, the people who gain from it generally don't come down here and talk about that, but people who lose are the ones that are more likely to be angry enough to take action on it.
Mm-hmm. Thank you. As I understand the bill, a situation could occur. Someone moves to Oregon. They're a long time insured. They have an excellent driving record. Their insurance company in another state is not available here in Oregon. So they're new drivers, let's say, and they're applying for the first time, and yet maybe they're 65 years old and been driving since they're 16. Their first-time drivers, so they would have the credit scoring applied to them, I presume.
Madam Chair, Representative Backlund, yes, they would. They're under the compromise bill, there will continue to be new applicants into the market, whether they want to move companies or new people into the state, who will, if they have bad credit, who will experience higher rates and potentially denial of insurance because of that.
Or if they had good credit rates in the other state, they would still, because you're a new applicant, it's possible their insurance rates could go up considerably here in Oregon over, say, what it was in another state.
Madam Chair, Representative Backlund, they had good credit history. They might be advantaged when they came here. They might get lower rates because they could still continue to use it.
Mm-hmm.
So, they're going to be winners and losers at that, but they're quite clearly under the compromise bill. New applicants into the market will continue to have the kinds of problems you've heard about with credit scoring.
Representative Berger. Yes, I have a file folder full of letters. half of them want a ban, and half of them want to be able to use credit. So can I say that this bill accomplishes all of the people that have written to me and takes care of them?
Mr. Chair, Representative Verger, I think you can say, on either side, you can say this could make everyone angry with you because no one gets fully what they want, or it's going to make everyone happy because they got something, yeah?
Oh, well, that wasn't what I wanted.
Further discussion. Representative Close?
I just have one comment for Joel. You use the analogy about old age and gray hair, and to me the difference is those are things that happen to people regardless of what they do or their actions. However, use of credit and loss ratio, some of that is based on your own decisions and how you live your life. So that's a big difference between aging. And I'll just tell you one conversation I had today with another representative who will remain nameless, but he said to me, how many tickets you had in your life? And I gave him the number of my very few tickets, and he gave me the number of his very large amount of driving tickets. And so what I would say to you is that people do drive differently, and loss is affected by that. So there's a difference.
Representative Flores.
Thank you, Mr. Ariel. Your comments have been primarily in regard to vehicle insurance. What is the actuarial evidence or the determinants in correlation to credit rating and homeowners insurance and other personal property insurances?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Forrest, very good question. They're generally the same. If anything, there's slightly stronger correlations in the homeowner context to the evidence that I've seen, so they're similar. Again, strong from the actuarial perspective. If you believe the statistical data, then they show the correlations for both the homeowner market and the auto market.
Okay. All right. Representative Backlund.
A comment again, Joel. I appreciate your testimony because you've laid out both sides and. I think it's been very helpful to us, certainly to me. So I appreciate discussing a full range of thoughts about this issue, and so it's been helpful.
I've been in a lot of those same kind of audiences as Representative Verger, and I need to be down in the middle on this.
All right, thank you. Appreciate your testimony. Appreciate your explanations. Steve Dixon.
All right. I don't know that I agree with him now, but I just want to get it.
Good afternoon, Chair Doyle, members of the committee. My name is Steve Dixon. I'm the consumer advocate for the Oregon State Public Interest Research Group. I serve on the Oregon Insurance Division Advisory Committee and also was a participant in the rulemaking that Administrator Ariel referred to earlier, and have been working on this bill or this issue for quite some time, along with a broad coalition of other groups, including the Oregon Christian Coalition, the Oregon Consumer League, many auto insurance agents or insurance agents. And we came together to push Senate Bill 260, which in its original version was a ban on use of insurance credit scoring. And we got that through the Senate by a vote of 27-2. The bill that you have before you is, I would say, better than the rules that came out of the insurance division. However, we do think that there is a lot more that can and should be done on this issue, be it this session or next legislative session. There are many, many problems that I'm going to try to go through with the use of credit scores for insurance determinations. The assumption behind credit scores is that if you have a bad credit score, you're going to be a worse risk and vice versa. Insurance credit scoring, however, is totally mystifying, I think, to consumers. I think it's pretty mystifying to regulators. I can't speak directly to Joel's experience, but he has mentioned, you know, there are a lot of unanswered questions, and I think it's probably pretty mystifying to you as well. The practice has never really been, in my view, independently analyzed in a way that I would say is acceptable. And if you were to ask the insurers who are going to come up and testify before you today, if you could look at the algorithms that they use to come up with the insurance credit score that then affects somebody's rates, I expect that they would decline that request. One of the initial first problems that I became aware of was that credit reports often have errors in them. We've done research, and the Consumer Federation of America has also done research that shows that up to 30% of consumer credit reports have errors in them that are serious enough to lead to the denial of credit. One would start to wonder how this would affect somebody if they're applying for insurance and have serious errors on their credit reports. Another problem is that it varies greatly from bureau to bureau. So the credit reporting bureaus may have X information but not Y information, and another bureau may have X information or Y information but not X information, and so on and so forth. The other problem, an additional problem, is that credit scoring is misguided because a good credit history does not equal a good score or favorable treatment by the insurer. Insurance credit scorings are not just based on bankruptcy, but they're based on other things, like the number of credit cards you have, the type of credit you're using. So a consumer finance loan would be worse than a bank loan. The length of time credit has been established, the number of inquiries. So if you were to shop around for a better deal on whatever you happen to be shopping around for, you would find that the number of inquiries that goes onto your credit report raises your credit score, and then you would be punished for with higher rates. Credit scoring, we think, casts too wide a net in people who are engaged in actually good financial management practices. Income loss and illness are the biggest cause of bankruptcies, whether it be terrorist attacks and people in the travel industry who lost their jobs, hundreds of thousands of them, and had to up their use of credit, or farmers in the Klamath Basin, or people who lost their jobs due to corporate accounting scandals, or any other number of problems that we've been experiencing with our economy. Those people will see higher rates if they up their use of credit. And clearly, it's kicking people when they're down, and I think it's an unconscionable use of credit information, especially in this economic climate, but really at any time. Then there's the problem of, is this a newer, sort of softer form of redlining? Freddie Mac, which is a reputable mortgage lender, has found that credit scoring has a disparate impact on people who are minorities or low-income individuals. So it's difficult to imagine how credit reports can have a disparate impact on people who are, are minorities in one market but not in the other. But of course, we can never tell that because we can't see the algorithms that are used to actually come up with the credit scores. Also, we think that one of the reasons for the correlation could be that it's a double counting. Essentially, age, students, for example, which is why the Oregon Student Association supported the ban, is that students who apply for insurance don't have much of a credit history. They may have a little bit, or they may have a bad one. They may have taken a lot of loans to go to school or buy books or whatever, and they're going to be saddled with higher rates. But they're also, their age is taken into consideration as well. It's unclear how paying a bill late or transferring debt from a credit card with a low limit to a credit card with a high limit is going to stop people from driving, good or bad or whatever. Of course, you could imagine, we want to create incentives to reduce loss, things like anti-theft devices, or you get a discount for that, or a surcharge for speeding, or whatever, an incentive to take a defensive driving course to get lower insurance. But I can't understand how this actually, how you moving debt from one credit card to another actually makes you a safer driver or reduces loss. There's also the administrative costs of using credit scoring. So there's, you know, you have to get the models licensed, and you have to comply with the Fair Credit Reporting Act, so there's additional costs there. And essentially, you could imagine a scenario where a drunk driver, someone with a DUI, got a better rate than someone who has never gotten a DUI, strictly because of their credit. And to me, that seems like a glaring problem that we need to address. And the industry, of course, has claimed there's a correlation, and I'm pretty much convinced that there is a correlation. I don't really think that that's the issue that's before us today. I think the NAIC, when they started examining credit scoring, I think this key issue is not about simple correlation, but whether credit scores are a proxy for other factors that are either not allowed or like race and income, or factors already used, such as age. And of course, you can find correlations, and the California Department of Motor Vehicles did a study that showed that people with dark hair are more likely to get into accidents, but does that make it a good public policy to start charging people with dark hair more for their insurance just because of the correlation? I don't think that majority benefits is also a good argument. For instance, we could start riding on race, and clearly the majority would benefit, but, you know, some people would be left in the lurch, and I would think wrongly so. And we also believe that credit scoring is a cherry-picking tool which allows the industry to quickly and easily assess which clients are more profitable based on income and not driving. For instance, a customer who can insure multiple vehicles at higher limits and also afford to buy other insurance products would be somebody you would want to welcome in, and those people who are insuring one vehicle at minimum limits are going to be less profitable, so you can also raise the rates on these people, being that there has been shown to be a correlation between income and bad credit scores. The bill, while I'm not exactly sure where I stand on this bill, but it doesn't protect, as Administrator Area says, it doesn't protect people who want to shop around. It doesn't protect people who move to Oregon from other states who are reapplying for insurance maybe with a different company. It doesn't protect the young. It doesn't protect people like myself who have a car and auto insurance but don't have homeowners insurance yet. And also, I think it's just as arbitrary to do it at the beginning as it is to do it upon renewal. That's why I think that we could do better on this bill. And I would urge you to at least take these comments into consideration when further discussions on the bill. So I'll be happy to take questions.
All right. Any questions? Representative Close.
Have you seen the amendments that were put in by the business committee?
I have. Okay. Yes. Chair Doyle and Representative.
I would like your opinion of the appeals process that we put in and some of the parameters we put in. What is your opinion on this?
Chair Doyle, Representative Close. My opinion on the appeals process is that the way credit scoring stands, you can change your credit score at any time. I don't know under this bill if you can actually change the credit score to determine who benefits or not. I know that you could do it at any time with credit scoring now, but I think that the appeals process is good for... I think it's better than the rules, and I think that it's very difficult for consumers to figure out if they get a report from the industry, from Fair Isaac or whoever's doing the model, I think it's very difficult for consumers to figure out what the exact right number of credit cards is, what the, you know, what kind of loan I should have out. Why should the industry be telling me how to manage my financial life? I've heard stories where somebody got a less than perfect, you know, offer because they didn't have a gas station card. And, you know, that was kind of clear, so the person could go out and get a gas station card, but then they might have too many credit cards. You know, that's the problem with the appeals process, but I do think it's somewhat helpful.
Well, these two companies that rate and give the credit score, is it your opinion that every insurance company uses ChoicePoint? Or if a consumer is denied at one insurance company and they go to another one, are they going to all be using the same figure?
Chair Doyle, Representative Close, I believe it's more than two that develop the credit scoring model. So I think Allstate has their own credit scoring model. ChoicePoint is certainly one of the biggies, as is Fair Isaac. And there may be other companies out there that have models as well. And I'm sorry, I forgot the second part of your question.
Well, I was just, my concern is that consumers get a fair shake if this happens to them. How able, in your opinion, are they to go to a different insurance company and have a different outcome? Or is it all locked up, in your opinion, that they would, the outcome would be the same wherever they went?
Chair Doyle, Representative Close, I think the outcome would be different. And again, the outcome would be different depending on which credit bureau you use. The thing is, my concern is that it's so arbitrary and so sort of out there all over the place that you don't know which, how you should have your credit or financial management set up. You don't know which company is using which credit repository. You don't know what the actual model looks like, and very few people do, that they use. So, I mean, you would get a different outcome, but that doesn't necessarily make it more justifiable or better.
Okay. Thank you.
Other questions? All right. Representative Barnhart.
Thank you. Have you had a chance to look at the Bureau of Business Research statistical analysis of the relationship between credit history and insurance losses report that Representative Close referred to with the last witness?
I have had a chance to, Chair Doyle, Representative Barnhart, I've had a chance to look over it. I've consulted people who, Bernie Birnbaum was the consulting economist for the Texas Insurance Division for quite some time, and he looked at it. He found that, you know, there may be a correlation. It probably is from double counting, you know, other factors that would lead somebody to have a worse insurance, you know, history. So.
Well, it's interesting to me as I look at this that the report makes it clear that it does not attempt to explain why credit scoring adds significantly to insurers' ability to predict insured's losses. So there, of course, it could very well be that it's credit scoring something else. I also note that in the design of the study, it talks about using, if I can find it again here, the loss ratios for the companies themselves, which of course immediately gets you into double counting. So I guess one of the, that would be the, my concern as well as the ones that that he indicated. Certainly you can't argue, assuming the study is accurate, that there's a relationship statistically between credit history and losses that could be predictive of losses regardless of what the reason for that correlation. I mean, is there a way of arguing against that?
Chair Doyle, Representative Barnhart, there are two things. The methodology And people that I've consulted with, I'm not a statistician, and I've never taken a statistics course.
Well, it's been a long time since I've analyzed something like this, and so I'm a bit rusty.
Right. And his comments were that the methodology that was used in the University of Texas study was the same methodology that the National Association of Insurance Commissioners dubbed another study that was to prove the same thing as misleading and counterproductive. Mm-hmm. Misleading and counterproductive, of course, does not mean wrong, but you know, that's all I can say to that. And that the other part of your question is that it's really a question of whether this is good policy, not about the, you know, math of it, the wonkishness of it, if you will. It's really about people, and we don't allow insurers to rate on the basis of race and income. There have been arguments that this is a proxy for race and income.
And if I can interrupt, this study certainly doesn't tell us one way or the other whether it's a proxy for race and income or not. Who does it?
Chair Doyle, Representative Barnhart, or any other factors for that matter. Yeah.
Right.
Age, for instance.
Other questions? Following up on that, Mr. Dixon, do you have any studies or any kind of data that would show people of different race or other minorities have lower credit scores than others?
Chair Doyle, there are lower credit scores for insurance or for mortgage lending?
Well, in the context, you're trying to allege mm-hmm. this to be a race issue.
Right. Well, I'm trying to allege it to be many, many different issues, not just that. That's just one factor. I think it opens up a huge can of worms. There have been studies done that have shown that it is a proxy for race and income, and you had gotten a letter from Bernie Birnbaum, and I believe I distributed that to the entire committee, where he states that he has. I haven't seen them, but he states that he does have those studies, and I could get him to provide those for you.
Well, we're not. I mean, we've had a couple of months, you know, to provide that kind of information, and not seeing it. I really kind of resent the implication, frankly. But without any statistics or any data to show it, you know, that kind of starts getting a little extreme, in my opinion. When you know, if you want to just look at just anecdotal evidence, I mean, there's plenty of rich white people that have poor credit just because they don't think about paying their bills on time, and they still have bad credit. So. And I think that's one of the points we'll probably hear from the industry is, you know, it's those people who tend to be a little careless, be a little bit more risk takers, also tend to have bad credit. I mean, that's just that's a potential or a possibility. So I would think that there's a lot of different issues, but just highlighting one piece to suggest, you know, that, you know, there's some other motivation on how these the companies or even how we're acting on this. I would just not deem proper.
Sure, Doyle.
The other thing I'm looking at is, you know, when you see success or failure of the B and gross version, if we pass this out today, and you had mentioned, you know, seeing what we might be able to do next session. How would you come back next session to say this particular plan either worked or it didn't work and needs to be changed?
Chair Doyle, it came to my mind that there was a study done by Alaska that showed that there was a disparate impact on the basis of race and income.
Do you have that?
I don't have it on me, but I've seen it through emails that were forwarded to me from someone in the insurance division.
See, and I guess I'm concerned that, you know, there's a lot of people come forward and just kind of throw things out without any proof, and you know, most of it you can kind of take with a grain of salt, but once you start getting into those issues without such proof, you know, I just don't want it.
I understand. I'm sorry, you had a second part of your question.
Can I break into this conversation a little bit? Because I think that, Mr. Chair, you're on to the key issue. When you raise the question of to what extent does the credit history reflect habits of behavior? And you raised that issue, and I think that's right on with the kind of thing that if in fact credit history reflects habits of behavior that are also related to the way people drive and the way the kind of accidents they have, then this analysis would be a perfectly reasonable way to pursue it. To the extent that it reflects extraneous issues, then it's not. And I'd like, if I could, just to point out that at least a couple of these extraneous things the bill has already tried to address. For example, on page 15, it attempts under section 4, and I'm looking at lines 12, 13, and so forth, right in that area. It does try to improve the credit rating a bit by taking out extra requests for extra inquiries, for example, in the event that somebody's bought a house or is searching for insurance or doing some of these other things. I mean, to some extent at least, the bill seems to take into account some of the things that might cloud the issues around the use of credit reporting. I agree with the chair. I think before we decide to dismiss credit history as a factor that's usable, we'd want some pretty good data that it really does reflect the issues that are already accounted for somewhere else or which are impermissible, like age or race or income, that are either already factored elsewhere or not permissible. And at this point, at least, we don't have the data that supports that. We don't have the data that detracts from that either at this stage.
Thank you. Mr. Dixon, I had asked before about your ability to define either success or failure of this version of the bill come next session.
That would depend on the effect that it had on consumers. I have gotten many complaints from consumers, and the agents that I've been working with have gotten a number of countless complaints from consumers, as has the insurance division.
So if it were
to continue to gobble up a lot of my time dealing with these, I think it would be a problem that would have to be dealt with. I haven't seen any information. There's just a lack of information on this issue. If this were to deal with the problems that I've seen or heard about out there in the world, then I would be satisfied with it. I'm not speaking only for myself when I say this, that other people who have worked hard on this bill would like to see a ban, but I think that this bill is a definite improvement on the rules that were adopted, and it's certainly better than no rules at all. And I guess that's the best way I could characterize my views on the bill.
So I guess all I heard then is if we come back in next session and we see fewer complaints to the insurance division or to you, is there any other ways to look at maybe quantifying whether we've actually done some good work here or that there's more work that needs to be done?
Chair Doyle, I think that's a discussion that needs to be had, and I would be happy to engage people in that discussion. I have thought about as much as what I've just told you about my response to the bill, and I would be happy to engage in that discussion with the industry, with the insurance division, and with all the other parties who have worked on this bill.
Okay. Thank you for your testimony. Let's bring John Pell and Sean Miller forward, please.
Mr. Chair, while they're coming up, I think maybe you saw on television where Bill Gates couldn't pay for his lunch the other day. He ordered a hamburger and a shake, and he reached for money and didn't have any on him, and they gave him a little credit.
And does he have gray hair?
I don't remember. You know, I don't think he does.
Was that junior or senior?
this was the Bill Gates. I don't know whether you call him junior or senior.
I'm telling.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Members of the committee, for the record, my name is John Powell. Before you, representing State Farm Insurance Companies and North Pacific Insurance Company, a Liberty company. I was going to ask the chair how we should proceed. I guess.
Did you have a request?
The new chair. Madam Chair,
no.
How we were going to proceed is Sean was going to give you a background of the bill. And that sort of thing, and I was going to walk you through some of the specifics of the bill so that hopefully whoever draws the short straw and carries the bill will have at least a running start. So would that be okay?
Okay.
Madam Vice Chair, members of the committee, Sean Miller, I represent the National Association of Independent Insurers, the Property and Casualty Insurance Trade Association, made up of 214 members that do business in the state of Oregon, approximately 35% of the personal lines insurance in Oregon. This has been an issue that the members that I represent have been working on, as you heard from Joel Ario, the administrator of the insurance division, for 18 months prior to this session on an administrative rule, which the bill actually codifies that rule. With the bills that were presented, Senate Bill 260 in its original form and two other bills in the Senate, the bill has obviously gone a lot farther than the rules. And I want to just go through three things, not only the background of why insurance companies use the credit-based insurance scores, but then I want to talk about the policy, and that's what we are here discussing today and you will contemplate. And then also talk a little bit about the Bean and Gross version of the bill and talk about the market disruption between the compromise version that it has taken nearly 4 to 5 months to craft versus the Bannon. So I'd like to talk a little bit about that. First, the background. I'll be very brief on the background and the statistical correlation because you've heard a lot of that before. I will reference the University of Texas study that Representative Close did go over. It was a study commissioned by the Lieutenant Governor of the state to examine the relationship between credit history and the insurance losses in the auto industry. And I'll just cite the conclusion, which was talked about, that the correlation, the credit score and relative loss ratio is 0.95, which is extremely high and statistically significant. The lower a named insured's credit score, the higher the probability that the insured will incur losses on an automobile insurance policy, and the higher the expected loss on the policy. Now, obviously, it's the correlation on why the insurance industry uses credit scoring, but I want to set that aside for now because I know this discussion has actually gone beyond why we use it, but I want to talk a little bit more about the policy.
Representative Backlund.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Sean, let me interrupt. I'm sorry.
Yep, no problem.
You're referencing the University of Texas study. The reliability, I've heard. What was the sample? I understand it's a very large sample.
It was this sample, right here. I believe it was 150. Mr. Chair, Representative Backman, it was 150,000 insurance policies.
That's great.
Yeah, it was a very large sample.
150,000.
Committee members, does everybody have a copy of that study?
Yeah. I don't.
I apologize, Mr. Chair. I thought those were all handed out ahead of time. I can give Janet this to. But I want to talk about the policy, first of all, and why we are here today talking about this particular bill getting past the correlation. And that was the issues, and Representative Berger references the letters that were sent to her and probably many of you by your constituents. And the testimony that we heard in the Senate committee and in the House committee involving
the policy of insurance scoring. And I want to point out that there's three different reasons, main reasons, and in the testimony, only reasons that we heard in testimony on this issue, and that is cancellation, which the rule took care of, because actually the rule then said that you cannot cancel someone's insurance based on their insurance score. That was codified in the bill. Renewal issues, so for instance, if you have an existing policy and on renewal you want to either go up or down on the rate, and obviously the complaints would have been increasing the premium on renewal based on part of the equation, the insurance score. And re-rating, which is, again, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, the existing policy of the companies, and re-rating those book of business to where some were going to have increases, and then sent out what the chair referred to as the adverse action notice, which is a notice required by law that says, yes, there's been an adverse action, and that's the reason why the increase in your premium. Those were the three issues, and I know, and I can probably bet that on all those reasons that Representative Berger's letters indicated are issues that we tried, the industry sat down, that is above and beyond the rule, and tried to solve, and that's what you see in Senate Bill 260. We believe it solves some of the issues outlined against the use of credit that were brought forth that you just heard from, while providing the least amount of market disruption. I want to talk about market disruption because it's been the toughest issue from a company standpoint that we've had to get our arms around, and that's why it took us so long to work on the language in 260. First of all, Representative Backlund referenced how many customers might be advantaged or have an advantage by the use of credit versus those that maybe have a disadvantage in the equation. And the companies that we have surveyed in our membership, on average, about 75% of the customers get a benefit from the use of credit. And so, you know, as you've heard, it's just one piece of the equation in a large equation to determine what the risk is on that individual and that customer. But because of their credit, 75%, when they ran the numbers, actually had an increase if you were to take that out of the equation. And so and from our standpoint, when we've run that numbers, the only proof that we've had on the result of that is something that Mr. Ario referenced, and that is the Maryland experience. Maryland is a state that has banned homeowners insurance. They were the last state to take action on a ban, and the General Assembly passed a bill in April 2002, banning the use of credit history. And since then, one company, Travelers, for example, 75% of their customers received a rate increase because of that ban. And so what we try to do is we want the least amount of market disruption by solving the problem, again, that we've heard in committee, that Representative Close heard in her business committee, and that the Senate heard on the issue of renewal, cancellation, and re-rating. People that have the existing policies, because people on the front end that are on the initial underwriting, which the bill does allow, is for us, in our industry, as a new book of business, the correlation is very important and probably one of the most determining factors for us to determine where in the risk they are going to be placed and how all that adjusts. Without it, it becomes it's a lot broader from our perspective. And again, we are not selling a product. We are selling a potential risk. And so for us, the tools are very important. So Representative Close referenced what she called the appeals process, and something that has not really been talked about yet, but in the bill it does allow, on the initial underwriting, if you do come and you come with a certain credit score in the equation, and over time your credit gets better and you want to re-rate, it actually allows the customer to actually tell the insurance company, re-rate me because I want a better and want to receive the advantages from credit. If we did not have that in this particular bill, you'd actually see more market disruption from company to company, because if you came in and you were unable to change, let's say over a five-year period, your credit actually got better, the only way for you to get a benefit and to move up and increase the benefit from your premium would be to move from to another company. And so you would have actually people switching companies, jumping around on this competitive nature. From a company standpoint, you know, my member said it's very important from a market disruption that we want to keep our customers happy and offer that ability. So again, we're trying to solve the problem, but also allow the flexibility to improve their premium over time and allow them, and the bill says once annually, and that's what I believe Representative Close was referencing to when she talked about the appeals process. Again, I want to turn it over to Mr. Powell now, but you know, the insurance industry has come a long way, and we believe it's a very good compromise. I know the last speaker mentions Alaska. Alaska just signed a very similar compromise bill, and the governor just signed it, I believe, yesterday. Is that correct? And so, you know, the study that you just heard, and we don't believe, and actually we do believe that what the last speaker talked about on race, that it is colorblind, that we do not use race, and it's not a factor at all in determining. It's strictly credit. You've also heard that this would put us at the top 10 regulations in the country. Very, very significant, and we are coming to the table saying we're willing to accept being in that top 10 of insurance regulations in the country. And
Mr. Chair,
Representative Barnhart,
could you say again what you mean by that? I'm not sure I understand what that
means. Yeah, Mr. Chair, Representative Barnhart, I think if you evaluate every state's insurance regulations involving the use of credit, we've been told not only by our insurance commissioner, this would put us in, you know, as of now, we only have the rule that's just gone into effect. This bill, if passed in its current form, would put us in the top 10 most stringent regulations on insurance scoring. I'm sorry, I did not clarify that.
Well, just to make sure, now with Alaska passing their bill, are we now out of the top 10? Should we be fighting to get back in?
You know, Mr. Chair, very comparable, but still, and they were one of the leaders in crafting this type of language. Lastly, the other, in a market condition, Joel talked about California. About less than a month ago, there was considered in the assembly a all-out ban on homeowners, and it did fail based on the market disruptions that I talk about. So again, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, we believe we've come up with a product that, you know, we can live with. It's been very difficult, I'll tell you, to get my members to come up to an agreement on this issue, because the first thing I talked about is the correlation, and it's a very strong correlation to them and the most important factor. And here we are saying the problems that were outlined in committee, we're willing to say to fix them. And that includes a ban on those issues, renewal, cancellation, and issues on re-rating. And so we feel that we've come a long way, and we would ask the committee to move the Bean Gross version of the bill and hopefully get this issue behind us. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Again, John Powell representing State Farm and North Pacific Insurance Companies. Mr. Chair, I'm going to start by substituting for Lana Butterfield just for 1 minute. She is feeling ill and has some surgery scheduled in the near future, and wanted me to put on the record a letter from her organization, the Professional Insurance Association, Agents of Oregon, as well as letters in support of the Bee Engrossed version from an insurance agent, Ron Passmore, in Lebanon, Oregon, who was on the task force that the insurance division put together on the rulemaking, as was I. Ron served on that. And from Kelsey Wood, an agent from Roseburg. So just supply those for the record.
Thank you.
Also, I'll give a copy of another study that was just finished in June of this year, which dwarfs the Texas study in size. This was commissioned, I believe, in cooperation with the National
Association of Insurance Commissioners. The study took into account 2.7 million earned car years, which is the equivalent of one car insured for 12 months. So this study took, in proportion, in all 50 states, insurance policies and matched those up with the credit scores in all 50 states, the equivalent of 2.7 million earned car years, and the conclusions are very similar in terms of the outcome and the correlation. So the staff can make copies for that for the committee as well. Mr. Chairman and members, what I want to do is to go through the bill. I think as opposed to try to answer many of the things that have been stated for the committee that I believe need correction, and I think what I will do in that regard is provide that in writing at a later date so that we don't go ad nauseum into the debate. But some of the things that were said do need to be corrected, and I will be doing that for the record. The bill that's before you is a little thicker than it needs to be, and the reason is there are conflict amendments from two other bills in this bill. So if you just sit down and start reading the bill, you say, I swear I just read something like that previously, and that's because they had to make provisions for each one of these bills in case they passed, and as a matter of fact, they both did pass, and so these conflict amendments will be codified with the statute so that all of the changes get into the law. But the first couple pages are definitional. And as you can see on line 7 of page 1, adverse underwriting decision is defined. That's already in the law. And cancellation, termination was already an adverse decision. But on page 2 at the top, lines 1 through 3, we further define adverse action to increase to include any increase in premium. So that was necessary in order to pick up any rating or increase premium effect on a consumer. As you can see on line 18, consumer is defined. At the bottom of that page, customer and credit history are defined terms. On page 3, insurance score is defined. And then finally on page 5, personal insurance is defined, which defines the lines of insurance that this bill applies to. And has been mentioned, it's your automobile, your homeowners, your boat insurance, and those sorts of coverages, including renter's insurance. And then beginning on page 5 is where we get into the conflict amendments. On line 37 says if House Bill 2306 becomes law, then this is the way the words will be matched. And that goes, that continues on until page 13, and on page 13 on line 14 it says if Senate Bill 253 becomes law, this is the conflict amendments. And so the meat of the bill outside of the definitional section of pages 1 through 5 is found on pages 14 and 15, and the two most important sections that articulate what the bill does begins on line 35 of page 14, that is section 4, where it says an insurer that issues personal insurance policies in this state may not cancel or non-renew personal insurance that has been in effect for more than 60 days based in whole or in part on a consumer's credit history or insurance score. And the 60 days is a look-back period that's already in the law. So that deals with the prohibition on canceling or non-renewing. Then if you look on page 15, line 39 through 42, at the end of the line 39, it says, if an insurer uses a consumer's credit history or insurance score in rating a policy of personal insurance at issuance, the insurer may only use rating factors other than credit history or insurance score to re-rate the policy at renewal. In other words,
You can't cancel or non-renew, and at renewal, you can only use other factors, not including a person's credit scoring. In addition to that, if you look back at the original section that bans cancellation or non-renewal on page 14, on line 38, there's a further restriction in that when you do use it at initial underwriting, as was previously stated, you can only use it in conjunction with other factors. It can't be the sole determinant of someone's position, either in terms of rate or whether there's satisfactory risk for that company. The bill also, has been pointed out, limits the types of credit that an insurer can consider. Beginning on line 42 of page 14, may not use the following types of credit history, and it goes on to talk about the absence of credit history. You cannot use the absence unless you have a filing that's approved according to rules that the insurance division will be promulgating. You cannot use credit inquiries that were not initiated by the consumer or inquiries requested by the consumer for the consumer's own credit information. So the point that someone made earlier, that if you're just checking on your own credit multiple times, or if you look down on lines 15 and 17, if you're shopping for cars and you're going around to several dealers and they're all checking your credit in a 30-day period, at most you can only count one of those inquiries. The same thing with shopping for mortgages. So as Sean pointed out, many of the concerns that came up both in the rulemaking process and at hearing have been addressed in the bill. Also on page 14 at the top, line 6 begins a notice requirement. If there is an adverse action taken by an insurance company, they must give you a notice of that. That notice must include the reasons for that adverse action, at least 4 in the descending order of importance, so that the consumer will know why their credit was bad in terms of what was used. That notice must give you instructions on how to contact the credit agency that's responsible for this credit with a toll-free number. That notice must give you information on how to obtain a free copy of the consumer's report that was the basis of this adverse action. So we've tried to answer the insurance agents, I think, brought to us a very legitimate concern in that they didn't know how to help their customer. They'd come in and they'd have a bad credit score. They didn't know how to help their customer. This section of the bill will give them information that will help the customer know why their credit was bad. Secondly, as has been pointed out, beginning on line 19 of page 15 is the ability for the consumer annually to ask to be re-rated. So if you are currently in a higher rated tier with a company because of your credit, as that credit improves, you will be able to be re-rated. And the same is true as if there's a mistake in your credit. The company must go back and re-rate you at the beginning of that policy period as if it had that corrected information at that time. So those issues are taken into consideration. And finally, on the last page of the bill, page 16 on line 11, deals with this transition period that Sean spoke of. If you're currently adversely affected by credit scoring, again, even if it's accurate, but your report improves annually, you have the right to seek a new rating from your insurer so that you would not have to go to a different insurance company in order to improve your rating. So we think this bill is sound public policy. We think it does answer the voices that came to the legislature and asked for relief. Quite frankly, not all insurers do apply credit equally. As one example, on auto insurance, this bill's passage will not affect the way State Farm or North Pacific has used credit. They've only used it on initial underwriting. They have not terminated people on renewal or increased their rates on renewal based on credit. So not all companies had used credit to the same extent that other companies have. But this clearly deals with the voices that came to Salem and asked for relief.
All right, thank you. Questions? Representative Barnhart.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm looking at the Section 5, of page 15, lines 43 through line 2 on page 16, which basically says that you can't use it at all unless you filed your system. Would you describe to us what these words, attributes and factors, on line 1 on page 16 mean?
Mr. Chairman and Representative Barnhart, I believe that that sentence is saying you must deliver to the regulator your model in its complete format so that it can be scrutinized by an actuary based on your filings so that they know exactly how that model works.
Okay, so follow up. So attributes and factors include the weights that you give to any particular factor?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Barnhart, that would be correct.
Okay, thank you.
Further questions? Representative Close?
I guess I'll follow up on that. So does the insurance commissioner or the director, they cannot disclose that, correct? I mean, if a Oregonian calls the department and wants to know what the algorithm is, they can't disclose that.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Close, that is correct. That is proprietary information.
Any further questions? Yeah. Representative Berger?
Yes, on page 14, let's see now, here it is, line 14. An insurer, an insurance producer may not use poor credit history or a similar phrase as a reason for an adverse underwriting decision.
Mr. Chairman and Representative Verger, that is a limitation on how the insurer reports to its applicant on the reasons for an adverse underwriting decision. What that paragraph says is you cannot, an insurer and its credit agency cannot get away with just writing you a letter and say you received an adverse action because you had poor credit history. It says you cannot do that. The sentences prior to that says you must give specific reasons why in descending order. If there were three reasons why your credit score was low, then they would give you those three reasons in descending order, the most important being first. So what that is a sentence to clarify the meaning of that paragraph to say you can't just tell them you have a poor credit history. They're likely to know that.
Follow up?
Sure, follow up.
Okay, you look at a credit history, there's a bankruptcy and two repossessions and a foreclosure. What do you write?
Mr. Chairman and Representative Berger, one of the differences between an insurance score and a mortgage score, for example, in mortgage lending, is that a mortgage lender will take most of the entire elements of a credit report into consideration. In insurance scores, what insurers have been able to do and these credit agencies have been able to do is limit the factors from the report that increase this correlation between credit and potential loss so that not everything is taken into consideration. But clearly, if you had repossessions and that sort of thing, if those were elements that led to this conclusion, it would either be in the form of did not pay bills or those sorts of things. I don't know that it would say specific to each failure to satisfy a creditor.
Just a quick comment, Mr. Chairman. I'm just always amazed and almost amused at how complicated our life has become. I can remember moving to Oregon in 1969 when the fishing industry was extremely successful, and people would come in and need to buy a truck because they needed to do their business. But they had no money to pay for the truck, but that was okay. They said, I'll be back when the fishing season comes in and I'll pay you. And do you know what? That was all right. And they did. And they came back and they paid. And so here we are. I just can't help but comment in reading this bill and compare some of my own personal experience.
Representative Flores.
Mr. Powell, you indicated in regard to inquiries, consumer-oriented inquiries, and if the consumer determined that their credit perhaps is improved, they could contact the insurance company and ask for a re-rating. Now, number one, do you have information that says that would indicate how common knowledge that is to today's consumer, that they would go check their credit score?
If I might name Mr. Chair, Representative Forrest. Actually, I have Elizabeth Masseri, who knows how to actually, on the Internet, there is actually an Internet site. If you'd like to hear, very simple, and she just did it on herself, that will actually explain to you and any consumer how to improve. And so some of the issues that you've heard from the prior speaker, that no consumer knows which is good, which is bad, they will tell you, and they will actually outline that out for you. So if you'd like to hear that, I do have an individual here, or I can provide that to you.
If you don't object, I just assume maybe we get some kind of document that way that we can actually put out on the floor to provide that information to all members as they're going to vote on that.
That would be interesting, but I just overall, you know, we are computer savvy. We know how to do that, theoretically. But, you know, the common average citizen normally, and I know that there's a lot of information out there, check your credit score and, you know, make sure it's correct, but perhaps the common average citizen just doesn't do that.
Mr. Chairman and Representative Flores, next time you ask me a question, I won't let Sean answer it.
You knew what I meant.
I would refer you to page 14, beginning on line 6, with the notice requirement. If you have been adversely affected by the use of your credit in relationship to an insurance purchase for personal insurance, you will receive a notice that tells you how to get a hold of the credit agency that's responsible for it, how to get a free copy of your credit report so that you can actually see if there are any errors on it or mistakes. So this sort of notice will let the person who is affected know firsthand what to do about it. So the bill does contemplate that issue and that problem of how do you get information to people so they can do something about their circumstances.
Okay.
Thank you. All right. Thank you for your testimony. Joel.
Thank you for the offer.
Ariel, you can come forward one more time. There's at least one question from a member, and several members. Representative Close.
Joel, I just wanted to confirm what the bill says here about the algorithm. Would you yourself have access to that, and then how would you handle that information?
Mr. Chair, Madam Representative Close, if you can show me the section of the bill we're in.
Okay. Page 16, section 5, subsection 2, the last page of the bill.
Okay.
1, 3, and 4.
One of the criticisms about credit scoring is that the final number that's reached, how they reach that number, the mechanism, is secret. And the criticism has been that the insurance commissioners of the various states don't know that information. So I think in this section of the bill, we've tried to spell out that the director would have the scoring model filed with them, but they can't disclose it as confidential.
Mr. Chair, Representative Close, 5 years ago, the users of these scoring models, the two primary vendors being Fair Isaac and ChoicePoint, would not share those with the regulator, and there were a lot of jawboning sessions. A couple years ago, they both essentially acceded to the regulator request to look at their information, and they have been providing it. They provided it to us, and they provided it to other regulators around the country. The way they have been doing it is, in a, they bring it in, and we sit in the room, and we look at it, and we can look at it as long as we want, and ask every question we want, and tear it apart in whatever way we want. And we've done that. Our actuaries have done that with the two models. This goes a little farther. It requires them to file it. It means we'd actually retain a copy of it, but it does protect the confidentiality. That has been very important to the vendors, because that's essentially their business. Is the algorithm is what the insurers buy, and if that was a public document, then they wouldn't have. That's a classic trade secret. I will tell you that one state has passed a law saying that the algorithms will be made public in that state. That's Michigan. I don't know exactly what's happening. That's in litigation there, but that's kind of a maybe broader answer than you needed, but yes, we already basically look at this, and this sort of allows us to keep a copy even on file.
Thank you so much.
Representative Barnhart.
Thank you, and this turned out to be a great order for these questions, because I had a question in the same section. My question is, okay, now you've got this algorithm, it's in the file, it's not subject to public disclosure, what can you do with it? How can you use it? I mean, what I'm thinking about is, can you go out and study to figure out whether it's a good way of evaluating the issue that they're trying to evaluate here? Or in what way
is it useful to you?
Mr. Chair, Representative Barnhart, what we do with the models is to tear apart the algorithm and look at the correlations between the various variables that go into the algorithm and insurance loss. So there are, these models, they used to have 60 or 70 variables. They have been reduced now. I think the forensic model has something like 16 variables now. And our actuaries look at those and look at the correlations in relation to each of those. And it's the same sort of process you were talking about with Steve Dixon is, if they have 16 of them, are there actually two of them that count for all the correlations and the other 14 are just kind of superfluous? That's the kind of questions that the actuaries test out with statistics when looking at the models.
Okay, so you actually didn't test them to see if you think that they're reasonable.
Mr. Chair, Representative Barnhart, yes. The one fundamental misconception, I think, is that the allegations that are made that none of this has been looked at by regulators and it's all a black box that's secret, that's just not true. I mean, the actuaries have looked at this stuff in a number of states, most states, and in order to have the funds, there is that kind of actuarial look. Every time I say that before I get excoriated, I want to then say that that's only a narrow part of the question that's in front of you, is a technical question about what are the actuaries think about the statistics. There are many other questions that are, I think, much more important in terms of your decision making, but on that particular piece, there has been a lot of review and a lot of scrutiny and a lot of different studies.
Okay, then the last piece on that one, if I could. Suppose you decided that you didn't like it because it didn't seem to reflect reality very well. What would you do then?
Mr. Chair, Representative Barnhart, we'd have to look to our statutory authority. In general, our statutory authority speaks to things that we can not approve because of the actuarial insufficiency of them. So when you use the phrase "don't like," it would depend on what the basis of not liking. But if it was, there's statistics here that show that there's a correlation, but I just find it, you know, personally odious that this connection is made. That would be the kind of thing that would have to be decided in the legislative body, not by my actuaries.
Right. I am talking about the statistical correlations.
Right.
Yeah.
if the statistical correlations are not there, we can deny use of that model. We do, on occasion, on filings, say there's a correlation here you've demonstrated, but you want 30 different rating cells, and we don't think the correlation merits having 30 different rating cells, so can't you have 15 instead? That kind of discussion goes on,
Thank you. Thank you.
Okay. Further questions? All right. Thank you. Appreciate your testimony. No one further to testify on this? Okay. Close public hearing on Senate Bill 260B and open up a work session on Senate Bill 260B.
Mr. Chair.
Director Flores.
Mr. Chair, I move Senate Bill 260B to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Flores moves Senate Bill 260B to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Discussion? Yes. Representative Barnhart.
Mr. Chair, earlier in the public hearing, I criticized the study that we had originally seen, the Texas study. And not really criticized it, but pointed out the limitations that the study itself indicated. We since then have received a copy of the EPIC study that was referred to, and I note that it brings in additional factors such as age and gender and geography, and I think also things like miles driven in the consideration of these issues, and still find significant correlation for credit rating with loss. So that deals at least with some of the issues that the other study doesn't purport to deal with, that I was wondering about.
Further discussion, Representative Mona Sanderson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. When I first was exposed to this credit rating, my first reaction was no way, because when I turned 40, circumstances in my life happened that I became a single parent, and all of a sudden I had to go get credit, and or at least insurance, and I didn't have credit, and it was extremely difficult. And so I was really prepared to vote no way on this, but because it does hurt women, particularly single women with kids, I feel. I know others were saying there are some racial issues also, maybe, that it hurts them. But the bottom line is I want legislation that's going to help the majority of ratepayers, and I think the insurance company has done a pretty good job in educating us. And so, especially since this seems to be a compromise with consumers, with agents, insurance agents, with insurance company, and with the department itself. And so I will be a yes vote. I still feel it's unfair to some of us who are really good credit risks, because now people know I'm a good credit risk. But initially it was a struggle, but it took a few years to prove that.
Okay. Representative Close.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just want the committee to know this has been the hardest issue that I've had to deal with the entire three sessions that I've been here. Because, you have to weigh moral issues with economic issues and fairness, and it's very difficult. But I have been really impressed with our insurance division and all the work that they did prior to us ever getting this bill. And I think the committee has had very good questions, and everybody's tried really hard to get to the heart of the matter. So I just want to say thank you to everybody.
Representative Flores.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I had earlier expressed to Representative Close my thanks for her vetting a number of the issues that have come before this committee, and certainly this one. I do appreciate her hard work. That being said, will provide a courtesy I vote on this bill. I did come into this bill kicking and screaming, not unlike many that I've spoken with. But I have to admit that the testimony is very compelling. My education on this matter is expanded enormously as a result of this hearing, and I really appreciate it. And I would like to read further, since I did not have a copy of the Texas study, and review that certainly before we go to the floor, and likely I will support the bill, but I still have some questions.
Representative Berger.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I guess that one of the things that I do really hesitate about is that we're constantly telling people how they ought to live and how they ought to run their business and over-regulating them. And so there's a part of me, having been through a number of regulations, that I'm hesitant when I see that kind of thing. Part of the reason, and I agree with Representative Coase, I think this is a difficult subject to really balance everything. And part of that is the attitude of the consumer, who really wants to be treated fair. And we represent people, so we want them to be treated fair. And then there's an attitude on the part of a lot of people that insurance companies are big, big, and they're just these big giants, and they're just going to pick on these little people, when basically they're totally unsuccessful if they do that and go out of business. So that's not their purpose in life. It is to be a good business people and try to be fair and to run a good business. So I, too, had a lot of concern about the bill. And also my mail running the way it did concerned me a great deal. I'm going to just go along with the compromise. I feel like there's been so much work done on it. And I will try to talk with a few more people before it actually comes to the floor. I'm not saying it's a courtesy vote, Mr. Chairman. I just would like to talk to a few more people about the compromise, because I think some of the people who wrote to me actually are confused about which bill they were writing to me about. And so I want to try my best to clarify that with my constituents.
Representative Macklin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My observations, as we've listened and asked a good number of questions, and we've had lots of things to read, including the bill itself, is that credit scoring works. And I recognize the concern on the part of many people, particularly who supported the Senate version of banning the credit scoring. But I think the compromise bill that we're looking at is a nice compromise. It maintains credit scoring, and yet it has many limitations. And it does have some nice features, such as the opportunity to ask for a re-rating annually. And in general, I think there's been a lot of work done here, and I think it's been pretty good work. And I will support the bill in committee, and I'm quite sure that I'll support the bill on the floor. Very sure.
Representative Barnhart.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I made a comment a minute ago about the statistical analysis of these issues, and I wanted to back up what Representative Backlund says. A correlation of 0.95, which means a variance of 0.9, is astounding. You don't find that very often in social science studies. That's a gigantic correlation. That means, in effect, that if the credit scoring is actually related to the same kinds of things that are related to accidents, that 90% of the effect can be measured using credit scoring. That is an astounding number. If in fact it carries through with in other studies as well, it's a very, very high number. And I can see, therefore, why the insurance industry wants to use it. It becomes a very good shorthand for what they can anticipate their losses to be for whatever reason. I'd like to understand a whole lot more than I do now about why it works. But I don't think that affects my vote on this bill. I mean, the bill itself has clearly been very carefully drafted to deal with the points at which insurance companies can use credit scoring. I certainly don't blame them for wanting to use it, given the enormous value it has for them and enormous predictive value it has for them. And some of the worst problems that people were concerned about seem to have been cleaned up pretty well by the bill. It looks to me like a good compromise. I suspect that if it's not, we or our successors will be back looking at it again.
Well, committee, I want to thank you for your patience in dealing with this issue, getting into the detail that we've had to. Really goes to, I think, the essence of our legislative body. I mean, as individual representatives, we are elected by our constituents to basically come to the Capitol to dig into the issues and really be able to get the detail that that they can't get themselves. And this is a classic example of kind of performing that duty, and I've been very impressed with the way that each of you have done that. At first blush, I agree with Representative Monis Anderson. This it just didn't make sense that you ought to continue having credit scoring for one classification, the new customers, versus those who are renewals. And yet, it started making sense as we started digging into, you know, pretty much where most of the complaints are coming from. And then also not just the correlation issue, but the fact that the industry needs a way to get to know these new customers. They need to know if they, you know, as much as they can about these people as they are, and it's all, you know, new customers, if they don't know them, like they have an established relationship, what better way than to, you know, basically, in my opinion, letting them do as they choose to get to know their new customers. Some use credit scoring, some don't. Some use them, they're very heavily reliant on them. Others just look at it a little bit more in passing. And that's, you know, the beauty of the market. And it's also the beauty of, I think, our own society's ability to go around and shop for the right insurance company that's right for them. So I didn't want to take that away as I started getting into this a little bit more, and I saw that the issue, at least from what I was getting in from my constituents and others who emailed me or telephoned me or visited with me, was pretty much heavily skewed over to the renewal side. And it's much more oriented to those people who came forward to say, I just got a letter and my rates are going up. It's not I was rejected by, you know, when I was applying for a new with a new company, but it's what my existing company's been doing. The insurance industry, you know, obviously saw the writing on the wall, and maybe that helped motivate them to come to consensus on some compromise. Because, you know, the alternative obviously, you know, not only impacted how they can determine their rates, but it also impacted their good credit customers. And I appreciate them fighting for those good credit customers, so that those people will still, I guess, be recognized. The folks who have good credit get recognition for that good credit, and the resulting correlation on claims that then results in a better rate for them. So, bringing it all together, I mean, I think I felt the same way as most committee members. I went through, I think, a lot of angst on which way to go with this. I knew we had to do something, and yet, you know, it was one of those kind of issues that that it took the work that each of us had to go through to come to this decision. Our role now is to go forward to our fellow legislators who at first blush may be thinking differently, to explain, you know, that after putting this kind of work into it, you know, we do understand what we're doing. We understand this is a good compromise. We understand it's going to be not just good for the industry, it's going to be good for the customers. It's a good consumer bill. And ultimately, consumers will benefit from this. and as we can move forward on this. You know, obviously, we've still got to take it back to the Senate. Hopefully, they'll concur. But, you know, again, I'm just very impressed and thankful for your work on this. Call the roll, David.
Representative Capua.
Aye.
Representative Barnhart.
Aye.
Representative Most.
Aye.
Representative Flores.
Aye.
Representative Mona Sanderson.
Aye.
Representative Berger.
Aye.
Chair Gallo.
Chair votes aye, and based on the good work that Representative Close's committee did on this bill before, I'm going to ask her to carry. If she would agree, she does. So with that, we will pass Senate Bill 260 to the floor with a two-pass recommendation. And nothing further before the committee. We are adjourned.
Okay.